You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, Talk Nation Radio.
Welcome to Talk Nation Radio, a half-hour discussion of politics as if the people mattered. I'm David Swanson.
It is my privilege to welcome to Talk Nation Radio this week, Rick Sterling. Rick Sterling is an independent investigative journalist who just wrote an article at consortiumnews.com called Amnesty International Stokes Syrian War. Rick Sterling, welcome to Talk Nation Radio.
Good morning. Good to be here.
Thanks for coming on. Thanks for writing the article. What is it that Amnesty International is doing to stoke a Syrian war?
Well, one thing they're not doing is following their own guidelines for investigative research. The Secretary General of Amnesty International has claimed that they cross-check, they talk to all sides of a conflict, they're very careful about getting different points of view, and they have their own people on the ground evaluating it, and they didn't do any of these things before coming out with this report, which I've referred to as a kangaroo report, in the sense that it appears that they had their conclusions that they wanted to put out, and then they portray the report as an exhaustive investigation, an interview with 84 people. But when you start going below the surface, it's clear they have no solid evidence, and even their witnesses are all anonymous.
So let's back up a second and tell people what this is about. Amnesty International put out a report about supposed mass hangings and extermination policies by the Syrian government in a Syrian prison. Is that right?
That is exactly right. And it was all over the media last week. The report came out last Tuesday, so 1 week ago, and it was on CNN, it was on PBS, it was on Democracy Now!, it was broadcast very widely. And yes, that's right. They basically are claiming that 5 to 13,000 mostly innocent, ordinary civilians were executed in mass hangings at Sednaya Prison, which is north of Damascus.
And they claim in the report to be quoting former prisoners, which of course suggests that not all prisoners are hanged if there are former prisoners out there, but they claim to have interviewed 31 of them. They've got before and after, you know, losing weight, photographs of three of them. They claim to have talked with four officials or guards. You say they're using hearsay and third-hand sources. Which is it? I'm confused.
Well, a couple of problems. One is that they're all anonymous. They don't give the names of any of their eyewitnesses. Another problem is that they gathered those.
They've got photographs of three of them with their names on them.
Those would be three exceptions then. Let's say that there are those three. Well, the people that they claim that they interviewed three judges, they claim that the four guards you're talking about, none of those people are identified.
Obviously, they could be lying. Obviously, Amnesty International is not some sort of saintly and organization
with
a perfect record. But don't people sometimes need protection? I mean, don't people sometimes deserve anonymity?
Sometimes they do. That's true. But in this case, it's pretty much across the board. I'll look at those photographs that you know you refer to, there's very little context given for those photographs, and they do not identify any of the. When they list the people that they interviewed, they don't identify any of the people there. So another important thing here is when they claim that they gather information from all sides of a conflict, and they did not do that in this case, and they haven't done it in their previous reports. They basically consult with groups like the Syrian Network for Human Rights, which has called for military intervention in Syria, and that is basically funded by the West. And they call they basically consult with groups that are explicitly on record as seeking the overthrow of the Syrian government. So, I mean, it's fine to talk with those groups, but you should be talking with other groups that will present a different viewpoint. And this is what they claim to do, and this is what they failed to do. Yeah. And within 48 hours of their report, Asad Abu Khalil's website called The Angry Arab came up, produced a story by a Syrian dissident who had been a prisoner at Saidnaya, and he contradicted all sorts of claims in the report. So this is the kind of thing that they Amnesty International says they do that they did not do in this report. That is, gather testimonies of people from different sides of a conflict.
Yeah, one of the you can tell us all the contradictions that you list in your article, but one point that's contradicted is the idea that a martyr's cemetery. They show photographs of, I think, three different cemeteries, and one of them is called a martyr's cemetery. The person that you're citing suggests that it's simply ridiculous that Syria would bury its people perceived as its enemies in a martyr's cemetery, and so in fact that actually is showing graves of Syrian members of the Syrian military. I mean, can you be sure of that? And what about the other two cemeteries? And why does Amnesty International think it knows who's being buried where?
Well, we can be sure that the Syrian government isn't going to bury people that they're executing in a martyr cemetery. That would be like burying somebody executed in the U.S. at Arlington. Referring to some of the other another one of the cemeteries, and this is referring to the there are a few photographs, satellite photographs in the report, which I recommend listeners to look at for themselves. It's not that long, it's not that hard to read the whole thing. They've got a few satellite photos. Another photograph shows a cemetery, and they estimate that there are 125 additional graves over 5 years. Well, that's hardly exceptional to have 125, especially in the midst of a war. So that doesn't prove anything.
Indeed.
So I think the main point was that those satellite images are either meaningless or they're ridiculous in the case of showing the expansion of the martyrs' cemetery. Now that the martyrs, going back to the martyrs' cemetery. The satellite image showed that it had doubled in size. What that proves is that a lot of Syrian soldiers and National Defense Force fighters are dying. And that's part of the reality of Syria that is never talked about, either by Amnesty International or generally in the West, that a huge number of Syrian soldiers have died fighting in defense of their country.
Right, of course. The article by Rick Sterling is Amnesty International Stokes Syrian War. To read Amnesty International's report, it's called Human Slaughterhouse, Mass Hangings and Extermination at Saidnaya Prison. The Amnesty International report also, as you state in your article, makes accusations against individuals without any evidence, including the religious leader, the Grand Mufti Ahmad Badreddin Hassoun, who, as far as we know, publicly has called for reconciliation, not advocated genocide. What's going on here?
Well, this is another, basically they give no evidence to back up their claim that the Grand Mufti and the defense minister and one other official, the Army Chief of Staff, are the three people who authorize each of these executions. They basically supply no evidence. They just assert that. And what I pointed out in my article is that the Grand Mufti, I mean, this is public record. There are recordings of the speech he delivered after his own son was murdered by the terrorists, where he called for reconciliation where he called for peace. He actually forgave the individuals who murdered his own son. So he and that is actually part of a very active reconciliation program in Syria, which is led by Ali Haidar, the Minister of Reconciliation. He's a cabinet minister. They have a very active program encouraging Syrians who have been paid to fight on the opposition to rejoin society and settle their claims. And if they haven't been involved in too extreme of atrocities, they simply are accepted back in society. This is another thing that's ignored and which contradicts this really preposterous claim that 5,000 to 13,000 ordinary civilians were hung. Yeah. It ignores the fact that there's a brutal Western, brutal war and invasion of Syria going on. It's well documented that many tens of thousands of foreigners have gone to Syria through Turkey, all of them funded and paid and supported and supplied by the West and by the Gulf states.
Yeah, some of the claims are pretty pretty hard to believe on their face. 95% of the people in this prison, ordinary civilians, seems right. Like it needs explanation. Other critiques of this report have looked at, alleged punishments, sticking a head through a hole and having it stomped on as something that wouldn't be survived. Things that don't seem credible without serious evidence. And the evidence isn't there. On the other hand, this is a report with a great deal of detail, as if a lot of research has been done. What is your thinking, or do you simply remain agnostic as to what the Syrian government is doing with this prison? Is the Syrian government not committing any sort of atrocities, or do we just not know?
Well, I'm sure the prison is a prison, and I wouldn't be at all surprised if there's not I wouldn't be surprised if there's torture going on there, and the conditions are brutal. They are in the midst of a brutal war, and there's many videos showing out how how the terrorists have executed, beheaded, and so on and so forth. It's a brutal war.
That makes it more or less likely, or somehow excuses atrocities by Syria.
Well, execution, they do execute. There is a punishment of execution in Syria, and I'm sure they're carrying out some. I'm not going to be surprised if they're carrying out executions, whether by hanging or a bullet to the head. But the claim, that's not the claim of this report. The Amnesty International report is claiming that 5,000 to 13,000 ordinary civilians, largely ordinary civilians, were killed in mass hangings. That's a big accusation that you need some really solid evidence for, and they have not provided solid evidence for that. It even runs contrary to logic. I mean, why would the Syrian government be executing, thousands of ordinary civilians? Another important fact here is that most of the huge percentage of Syrian civilian population is in government-controlled areas. As soon as the terrorists take over an area, the large percentage of civilians leave. They depart. They go to where they're protected by the government.
Yeah, it seems implausible that exactly what Amnesty claims is happening, but the logic they're looking for, I think, is that the Syrian government is simply insane and engaged in genocide. The word that's repeated throughout the report is extermination, with not just hangings but deprivation of food and medicine and so forth. Are they not looking here for a charge of genocide?
Well, they could be. They seem to be trying to build a case for foreign, escalated foreign intervention, and that's the real danger here. Very soon at the end of February, there's supposed to be new negotiations taking place in Geneva. This is following on the Astana negotiations that took place. Now, you know, more influential members of the opposition have decided to join the negotiations. Now, the question is whether the opposition is going to negotiate seriously or not. In the past, they've walked away from negotiations. When the Syrian government has come to the table, the opposition typically, and usually guided by their so-called High Negotiations Committee, is basically heavily influenced by Saudi Arabia, and they basically leave. They lay down a precondition. Bashar al-Assad has to step down before we'll talk. So they basically torpedo the negotiations. In the past, another feature of past negotiation efforts has been there has been a sensational charges will come out just in the preceding days or weeks, accusing the Syrian government of some kind of atrocities. In February 2014, Geneva negotiations were going to take place, and literally the day before the negotiations were supposed to happen, it was all over the media that a Syrian photographer, codenamed another, again anonymous, codenamed Caesar, had 55,000 photographs showing the brutal execution in Syrian prisons of 11,000 detainees.
Yeah.
This was a campaign funded, openly funded by Qatar, and it had some lawyers, basically lawyers for hire, had said they had looked at it and they authenticated it. This is referred to in the Amnesty International report. Well, I investigated that and discovered that there was all sorts of very strange stuff going on there. The photographs were, these 55,000 photographs were never released to the public. A very small number of them were, but Human Rights Watch actually got access to the photographs, and they had to acknowledge that almost half of the photographs ended up showing the opposite of what was claimed. Instead of showing executed prisoners, they showed actually killed Syrian soldiers and civilians who had been killed in car bombs.
Yeah. The tricky thing here is to figure out what Amnesty International is after, because their recommendations at the end of this report, you know, recommend a referral to the International Criminal Court and seemingly use of the rule of law and investigations and so forth. But they never make any reference to the fact that there's a war going on. They never propose peace negotiations. They don't openly propose escalation of the war or overthrow of the government. But they say the UN Security Council must act, and we all know what that tends to mean in Western media.
Right.
And there's a history that you mention in your article with the incubators and the babies in the Gulf War, with Gaddafi and the, you know, fraudulent charges of looming civilian massacre. What is Amnesty International's record here, and do you think they're really pushing for steps toward an escalated war?
Well, I think Amnesty and the other big NGOs such as Human Rights Watch have played a very active role in the conflict, and they're very they basically do not talk about the role of the West and the Gulf in funding and arming and basically organizing the attack on Syria. This is, you know, by the Geneva Conventions, this is actually the supreme crime, is the initiation of war. And in the case, Nicaragua took their case against the U.S. for funding and supporting the Contras in Nicaragua. They took it to the International Court of Justice at The Hague, and they won that case.
Right.
And it was after that the so-called International Criminal Court was created 15 years later. And one of the roles of the International Criminal Court, actually, whether intentionally or not, has been to undermine the International Court at The Hague. And so a lot of the talk now, if you look at the reports of Amnesty or Human Rights Watch, they never talk about who starts a war. Human Rights Watch did not even oppose the U.S. invasion of Iraq.
No,
they did not oppose it, but they said that the U.S. wasn't ready for the consequences of the war. So, and in the case of Amnesty International, in this report here, they talk about a violation of humanitarian law and things like that, but they ignore the fact that Britain, of course, Amnesty is based. It's large in the U.S. and it's large in the West generally, but its headquarters is in the U.K. The U.K. has been involved in supplying militant factions in Syria from the get-go.
Yeah, I've had discussions with some of Amnesty's top staff repeatedly over the years about this, and they take a principled, what they call a principled position, that they will ignore the existence of the UN Charter and the Kellogg-Briand Pact and any laws against war in order to address only the particular atrocities within a war. But then they will take out advertisements cheering for NATO's ongoing war in Afghanistan, for example, and never,
right,
never against a war, never for ending a war.
Right.
So they you know, but have they done reports on atrocities by other parties in Syria as well?
They have. They've done some reports on the imprisonment of Syrian civilians by opposition groups, whether it's the so-called Free Syrian Army or Jabhat al-Nusra. They've done some reports, but those tend to get – they don't get that much publicity. And the whole emphasis – and Amnesty will come right out and say explicitly that the majority of detainees, the majority of civilians killed is from the government side. And that is really disputed. Now – the important thing here is that they are not talking to all sides of the conflict. They're basically talking in southern Turkey to groups and individuals who are put forward by groups seeking the overthrow of the government. And here's our big point, that they aren't doing what they claim they should be doing, which is talking to all sides and then finding out and cross-checking. Now, and so the example of Nizar Nesuf, who was the Syrian dissident who had spent time in Sednaya, he even contradicted what, you know, which was the main building. Was that the red building or the white building? He had all sorts of statements in there, and if Amnesty had done what they claim they do, they would have had contrary information that would have given them more of a basis to find some accurate findings. Anybody who goes to Syria and travels around and talks with people on the street randomly will very soon learn that there is overwhelming support for the government there. Not that they're in love with the Ba'ath Party or necessarily with Bashar al-Assad, who is popular, but not everybody likes the Ba'ath Party. They certainly don't like the security services, but they hate the terrorists. They hate the groups that have been funded by the West and the Gulf that have destroyed their country.
Yeah. Well, I mean, all this context is missing from Western media in general, and peace activists
right.
go to Syria, former Congress members, current Congress members go into Syria. Amnesty International says it's not allowed in. But the question of the accuracy of this report, seems to be a separate question, and it's very hard to say without other reports what exactly
right. Well, they don't have to go into Syria. They are suspect. The Syrian government, suspects they're up to no good. Suspects that they're basically working for the enemies of Syria. And you can look at some evidence to back that up. For example, the role that Amnesty International's reports and accusations made leading up to the NATO, overthrow of the Libyan government and then going back to the Gulf War I. But Amnesty they don't have to go into Syria. They don't have to talk with Syrian officials or people there. They could talk with all sorts of groups. There are lots of groups. There's the Syria Social Club in the U.K., that is basically comprised of Syrians who could have put them in contact with people. And that's why the individual who came forward within 48 hours of their report, refuting major elements of it, you know, that Assad Abu Khalil was in contact with.
Has Amnesty replied to any of those statements that have come out since the report?
No. Well, their report just came out, as we said, a week ago, and it was widely publicized last week. It was actually, and Amy Goodman on Democracy Now! Interviewed the co-author of the report.
Right.
I believe it was Thursday. That's Nicolette Waldman. But it was a very uncritical interview. There's been critiques of it, and my article has been published in several places.
Yeah.
But they actually need to be held to account, because Amnesty International has done a lot of good research and done a lot of good reports over the years. It has a good reputation. It has a huge, you know, war chest. They've got their annual budget is in the hundreds of millions.
Yeah.
But they need to be held to account, and they need to, if they are being biased, that needs to be talked about and corrected. And the same, I would make the same suggestion regarding Democracy Now.
It seems to me the important point here is that even if a speck of it is true, even if Syria has tortured a single person or murdered a single person, that's too much. But no matter what they've done, there's no legal or moral or practical justification for escalating a war and making everything even worse. So we ought to get the facts right, but not use them as war propaganda. And we have just a couple minutes left, but Amnesty also put out a cartoon video to accompany this report depicting Syrian evil. Is that part of their normal routine?
Well, sadly, they seem to be relying more and more on gimmicks like that and expensive graphic reproductions. They did a big expensive graphic, graphic creation of the which they purported to be the prison based on sounds and so forth. And the cartoon is it's literally a cartoon, and it. The cartoon basically portrays this story of a peaceful protester who was a nice family guy, and he went to a couple of peaceful protests. Then he got arrested, and he ended up getting hung at Sednaya.
Yeah, yeah.
Well,
30 seconds left.
This is the narrative, that it's the Syrian government abusing and killing innocent Syrians, and they leave out the fact that there is a war going on, the war of aggression, that there's over 100,000 armed militants who behead people, who attack, who do car bombs, who launch mortars into civilian areas every day, and they are ignoring that.
Yeah, they are, and Western media is ignoring it, and although it does not justify, in my view, any violence from the other side. Rick Sterling, terrific of you to question this report and point out the contradictions and the doubts. Greatly appreciated. Thanks for coming on Talk Nation Radio.
Yeah, my pleasure, David.
This is Talk Nation Radio. I'm David Swanson. Take action at rootsaction.org. Help end war at worldbeyondwar.org. All past shows can be heard at davidswanson.org. Talk Nation Radio is produced in Charlottesville, Virginia, and syndicated by Pacifica Network. If you are listening to a nonprofit station, please support that station. Talk Nation Radio is funded by contributors at davidswanson.org. There is no way to peace. Peace is the way. Until next time.
Free Radical.
Coming up next, Talk Nation Radio.
Welcome to Counterspin, your weekly look behind the headlines. I'm Janine Jackson. This week on Counterspin, T-Mobile very pleased with direction of change under Trump administration, CEO says. That headline tells you pretty much what you need to know about Ajit Pai, Trump's choice of chair for the FCC, the entity charged with representing the public interest in the communications field. The phone company executive is pleased, he says, because Pai's appointment signals an air of less regulation. What's objected to, of course, are public interest regulations, including the net neutrality rules that allow for a democratic and diverse internet. So what's ahead for the public interest under Ajit Pai's FCC? We'll talk with Jessica Gonzalez. She's deputy director and senior counsel at the group Free Press. That's coming up, but first we'll take a look back at recent press. Donald Trump's executive order temporarily banning refugees from seven Muslim-majority countries has been a major story, with much coverage focused on the widespread backlash to the ban, including legal challenges and rapid response airport protests around the country. But as media critic Reed Richardson notes on Fair.org, coverage of opposition to the ban has also sparked a kind of reflexive counter-narrative within the corporate media. There's a competing genre of story in which, Richardson writes, the press parachutes into red state diners, barbershops, and grocery store parking lots to seek out Trump voters, and only Trump voters, to gauge their support for the ban. The news in these news stories is unsurprisingly unsurprising. Turns out the same people who consistently backed the idea of a Muslim ban during the primaries and after the conventions also like Trump's current Muslim ban. Nevertheless, this dog bites man story has been given pride of place in outlets from the AP to the New York Times to CNN to NPR. It's fine for media to try to understand arguments animating both sides of an issue. But the thing is, there's only one side that's animated over the ban right now. So in effect, these Trump supporters support Trump ban stories share an implicit bias in their framing, which is that overwhelmingly white Trump voters deserve rarefied, privileged attention by the media, even when doing nothing newsworthy. Besides the double standard, says Richardson, these stories show media carving out what you might call a journalistic safe space for Trump supporters to air their support free of context or fact-checking. For example, Richardson found many stories in which Trump supporters conflate immigrating refugees with terrorism. But only one article from Huffington Post bothered to point out the logical disconnect, the risk of dying from a terrorist attack carried out by a refugee being something like 1 in 3.6 billion per year. Russia, of course, has been much in the headlines and with good cause, but some conversations raise the question of just how evolved U.S. media's geopolitics are. When Donald Trump was asked by Fox News's Bill O'Reilly why he wouldn't condemn Vladimir Putin, whom O'Reilly called a killer, Trump responded, "You got a lot of killers. What, you think our country's so innocent?" As Adam Johnson noted on Fair.org, this provoked outrage on the part of liberal patriots, like the New York Times editorial board, whose February 7th column, Blaming America First, said, quote, "Asserting the moral and political superiority of the United States over Russia has not traditionally been a difficult maneuver for American presidents. But rather than endorsing American exceptionalism, Mr. Trump seemed to appreciate Mr. Putin's brutality, which includes bombing civilians in Syria and, his accusers allege, responsibility for a trail of dead political opponents and journalists at home. and suggested America acts the same way, close quote. The perhaps 1 million civilians who died due to George W. Bush's unilateral invasion of Iraq alone would show the absurdity of suggesting respect for civilian lives as something that elevates the U.S. above Russia, before you get to the thousands killed in Afghanistan, Libya, and Syria itself, to name some. And yes, Russia's violent stifling of dissent is terrible, as is the United States' harsh punishment of whistleblowers, infiltration of dissident groups, and bombing of foreign journalists. Johnson suggests our record-breaking incarceration system and persistent institutional racism, if we're going to talk human rights abuses. The paper mentions the Iraq War and torture, calling them terrible mistakes. And it goes beyond implying that whatever harms the U.S. does have the best intentions. Quote, at least in recent decades, American presidents who took military action have been driven by the desire to promote freedom and democracy, sometimes with extraordinary results, as when Germany and Japan evolved after World War II from vanquished enemies into trusted, prosperous allies, close quote. Well, the point isn't argued, it's just an article of faith that the U.S. killed an estimated 3.8 million people in Vietnam to promote freedom and democracy, despite President Eisenhower's admission that given the chance, 80% of the Vietnamese people would have voted for Ho Chi Minh, or that the use of covert terror to try to overthrow the elected government of Nicaragua or military support for death squad regimes elsewhere in Central America were likewise inspired. As Johnson notes, it certainly is not that Trump's motives in questioning American innocence were noble. He was evoking America's own sins, not to challenge them, but to apologize for those of the Russian president and, maybe preemptively, his own. But the media outrage around his comments didn't spotlight that scary cynicism. Instead, it talked down to readers who deserve better with an insistence that the U.S. operates on a higher moral plane. And finally, since Donald Trump announced Neil Gorsuch as his nominee for the Supreme Court, media seem to have coalesced around a few themes. One is about whether any Trump appointment should be blocked as payback to Republicans. That's expressed in the New York Times headline, Democrats' quandary on Gorsuch, appease the base or honor the process. Spoiler, the paper thinks the real strain is on those in the middle. Another theme is Gorsuch's eloquence and his being hard to pigeonhole as conservative. Apparently, he didn't skip a beat when a friend came out to him as gay. There are stories around concerns about Gorsuch's record on the U.S. Court of Appeals for the Tenth Circuit. They focus on his justifiably concerning ruling in the Hobby Lobby case, where the chain store won the right to deny employees contraception coverage, and in which Gorsuch described birth control, falsely, as destroying a fertilized human egg. But the lens corporate media use for Supreme Court nominees has some blind spots. In this case, you could read all the elite press have to offer on Gorsuch and never hear about human rights for people with disabilities. You'd have to find ACLU attorney Claudia Center's piece on their website to learn about Huang versus Kansas State University. That was a case brought by assistant professor Grace Huang, who was returning to work after a leave of absence for cancer treatment when the campus broke out in a flu epidemic, leading her to request to work from home for a short period as her immune system was weakened. Judge Gorsuch sided with the school that this request was unreasonable, and he said that disability rights rules aren't meant to, quote, turn employers into safety net providers for those who cannot work, close quote. That call, which Center notes represented errors of both fact and law, went against every other circuit decision on the issue, as well as guidance from the EEOC and the Supreme Court. But a search of major media on Gorsuch and Huang turns up zero stories. Despite disabled people constituting some 19% of the U.S. population, that's nearly one in five people, according to the Census Bureau, how the highest court in the land may affect their ability to work and live just isn't interesting to corporate media. With a president that openly mocks disabled people, that kind of disinterest is even more dangerous. You're listening to Counterspin, brought to you each week by the Media Watch Group FAIR. regulators who don't much believe in regulation are looking like a hallmark of the Trump administration. What does that mean for the access to communication and information that's critical to our daily lives? The newly appointed chair of the Federal Communications Commission, Ajit Pai, doesn't want to actually eliminate the agency, as far as we know. But what does his record suggest for his term leading what's meant to be the public's advocate in the communications realm? Jessica Gonzalez is deputy director and senior counsel at the group Free Press. She joins us now by phone from Los Angeles. Welcome to Counterspin, Jessica Gonzalez.
Thank you.
Well, like the new administration overall, Ajit Pai has come out of the box with a flurry of things. A number of them came out on a Friday and sort of went under the radar. I would like to start, though, with the digital divide, which is not a thing of the past, as many people may think. There are still many who, for reasons of locality or of affordability, cannot get reliable internet access. Now, Ajit Pai, I understand, has said that the digital divide is a top priority for him. Is that convincing?
Well, I think with Ajit Pai, much like his boss at the White House, that we need to really watch what he does and not what he says. He's talking a really good game on digital divide, but when you look at his history and also his plans for the future, it tells a very different story. If you look just going back into his past, because he has been on the commission for many years now, we know that he voted against Lifeline modernization. And that proceeding is set to bring broadband to millions of poor Americans. He also voted against E-rate modernization to help bring faster internet speeds and internet connections to schools and libraries in poor neighborhoods. And when we look at what he's done since he's been the chairman, he's spelled out a comprehensive plan that he says will bridge the digital divide. But in fact, what it is tax breaks for wealthy companies to build and to overbuild high-speed internet across the country. And this does not address the main barrier to broadband adoption for poor Americans, which is the high cost of the services. And so he's worked to undermine Lifeline, which is the only federal program that helps make home broadband access more affordable. And he's voted against arming schools and libraries with affordable broadband. Not only that, in the sweeping order that you mentioned in the intro, the Friday news dump, if you will, he actually took a specific action to undercut the efforts of nine companies that were preparing to provide Lifeline broadband services for poor folks. So his actions tell a very different story, and I don't believe that he has a sincere commitment to bridging the affordability gap.
Well, let me just ask you about Lifeline. That is a federal program that basically just offers, it's like 10 bucks or something. Can you explain just a little bit for folks who don't know what Lifeline is?
Sure. Lifeline has been around since 1985. Actually, a few years back, I was personally on the Lifeline program, and it helped me connect to job opportunities and helped me actually communicate with the financial aid office at my law school. And so it really is, like it was for me, it has been a pathway out of poverty for millions of Americans. And what happened in 2016 is that the FCC modernized the program for the digital age and made this $10 subsidy available for broadband services. And this is incredibly important. Our school children across the country are being asked to learn online, of course. There are tons of services and job applications. Something like 80% of Fortune 500 companies accept job applications online only. And so being without the internet puts folks at an incredible disadvantage. And this is something people who are already on the internet understand, but it's also something studies show that people who are offline understand as well. And so we really need to close this divide at once.
I want to direct folks to a report that Free Press has done called Digital Denied. Well, 16 years ago, I wrote about the then new FCC chair, Michael Powell, and he had infamously said of the digital divide, "I think there's a Mercedes divide. I'd like to have one. I can't afford one." He always claimed he was taken out of context. He was actually perfectly clear in expressing his sentiment. And the idea is that it isn't the government's job to ensure equitable access to communications technology. You just let the market work its wonders. Now, Ajit Pai, I think, is maybe too savvy to make that sort of joke, but the approach seems very similar. He's talked about how the government shouldn't intervene and muck up the internet, you know. And there, of course, he's talking about net neutrality, and that's the largely democratic nature of internet access that's absolutely crucial to, among other things, organizing. So let's talk about net neutrality and what the concerns are on that front with Ajit Pai.
Ajit Pai voted against net neutrality in 2015. He's been very clear that he does not support the legal pathway that the FCC took to get there, and that he doesn't think that the FCC needs to be involved in keeping the internet open and free. And I think pretty much any cable or broadband consumer understands that the free market is not working in this instance. Many of us have only one choice for how we get access to the internet, and we feel ripped off by our internet providers. Mm-hmm. We know that they have leverage in the relationship, and it's unfair, and that the government in this instance does have a role to play. And wonderful things have happened on the internet under net neutrality. People of color who have not traditionally had a voice in mainstream media have been able to tell their own stories. We've been able to organize. We've been able to make a living. And it's not just people of color. It's democratized the entire way that people share and get access to information. So it's incredibly crucial, especially as we resist this administration, that we have access to the tools that we need to communicate and organize. And I'm really concerned, frankly, that there's a pretty clear theme emerging from the Trump administration. We have his spokespeople telling the media to shut up, to not cover issues. We have, you know, them covering up facts. And then we have Ajit Pai at the FCC who wants to undo net neutrality and shut down the way that we can communicate and organize. And so it's a very troubling pattern, and I think we need to speak up and speak up loudly.
As the internet became so key to organizing, and as media became more of a politically understood issue, or understood as a political issue, the FCC kind of came into the spotlight, and the victory on net neutrality of having the internet declared a public utility, and a federal court has upheld that, was seen as absolutely critical. And yet I also feel that people, it's kind of under people's radar. They don't necessarily see it as an issue that will affect their ability to organize around healthcare, their ability to organize around policing. You know, media policy has often been a kind of difficult sell in terms of its activist meaning. If Ajit Pai now sort of says, well, Congress has to do everything, the FCC can't actually do very much, what does that mean for organizing around media policy issues?
Well, luckily, I do think that we're reaching a critical mass on these issues. I mean, after the John Oliver piece that called out Tom Wheeler and urged him to reclassify the internet as a utility, like you said, we saw 4 million people sending comments to the FCC on a wonky technical media policy issue.
Right.
And that was amazing. I mean, that was the most comments that the FCC had seen since we saw Janet Jackson's nipple at the Super Bowl. So I do think there is a rising awareness about these issues. I think activists from all kinds of different movements, Black Lives Matter, this is part of their policy platform. I think, you know, as we see these movements that are mobilizing largely online, and we see amazing organizations like Color of Change and Presente.org and 18 Million Rising that are using the internet to organize for immigration reform and for racial justice and so many other things, we see this rising awareness among activists and their followers that this is an issue that is important. And I've been really encouraged by the rising tide of activism, and I do believe we need to continue talking about this, of course, but this is more, I think, in the public eye than it was a few years back even.
Well, let me ask you about one activist victory that I know Free Press was involved in, and the Center for Media Justice and other folks, and that was to cut into the racket, essentially, that phone companies have with prisons. I wonder if you could tell us a little bit about what happened there, because people may not know, but then also, is that victory also in danger?
I'm sorry to say that the victory is in danger. So what happened was, in 2013 and 2015, the FCC visited the issue of the exorbitant rates of prison phone calls and the fact that some families were paying as much as $17 for a 15-minute call with their inmate or detainee relative. And not only that, that prisons were actually receiving kickbacks from some of these phone companies to exploit the prisoners and detainees. And so it was a really horrendous and despicable practice, and the FCC voted to caps and fees that the prisons and the prison phone companies were charging. And it was a huge victory that was challenged in court. Ajit Pai voted against prison phone justice on two different instances, despite the fact that he acknowledged that this was an unjust system, is that the interests of prisons and prison phone companies may not necessarily align with the prisoners and the detainees. Yet he went ahead and filed a 20-page dissent and parroted the talking points of the prison phone companies. And so right now, the 2015 order is in litigation, and Ajit Pai has refused to defend it. And so we don't know exactly what's going to happen. He did allow an attorney on behalf of the activists a few minutes of oral argument, but it's really up to the courts, and it's very discouraging and disheartening. And I think it really goes back to the question of whether or not he is a legitimate advocate for poor and for people of color who are disproportionately represented in the prison population.
I think that's one of the areas that folks might not realize that the FCC could actually play a role in. You know, they actually are involved in many things that folks may not know about. And one issue is that they've never been a terribly transparent agency. There are public comment periods when the FCC makes rules, but you kind of have to know about them. And another thing that Ajit Pai talked about was increasing the transparency of the work that the FCC does. But then there again, there seems to be a gap between what he's saying and what he's doing. I mean, the pushing out of these orders on a Friday afternoon doesn't seem to bode very well for the openness of the agency.
I think you've put your finger right on the problem. I mean, it was just incredible to me, the doublespeak that happened in his first couple of weeks in office. He came out with a flash saying that the agency needed to be more transparent. And then a few days later, basically taking a note from the Trump playbook, he had several of the bureaus underneath him issue executive-type orders on what's called delegated authority. And, I mean, I have a list here. There's actually 9 different things that he did, but he closed an inquiry on zero rating, which is tied to net neutrality. And this was really just like a fact-gathering initiative. He stopped 9 companies from providing lifeline service to their consumers. He killed some guidance on how the agency should look at media ownership limits. He killed an inquiry into flexible use of the electromagnetic spectrum. He rescinded a report on how to improve digital infrastructure. I mean, he rescinded an E-rate progress report. And so it's incredible. He is getting rid of facts that may be inconvenient to his political agenda down the line. And these reports have absolutely no legal or political bearing. It's just really facts that the agency can use to make reasoned decision making. The list goes on and on. I won't go down, I guess, the laundry list, but it's really disconcerting that this person is talking about transparency and in the next breath, he's trying to dump a bunch of stuff that undermines consumer protection all on a Friday afternoon.
Absolutely. And in fact, you mentioned that he did it on what's called delegated authority, which means he didn't have to bring it to the vote. And in fact, the Democratic commissioner, Mignon Clyburn, said, you know, she had hoped to review some of these things and she didn't have an opportunity to. They were just kind of rushed out the door before even other commissioners could look at them, which is Disheartening,
yeah,
indeed.
I would really, she wrote a great dissent, and she's written a number of great pieces, and I would really look to Commissioner Clyburn moving forward to tell the truth of what's going on at the commission. She's always stood on the moral high ground and been a fierce champion for consumers, and particularly for consumers of color. And she is the one that I look to at this time to really hold the agency accountable. And she did say she asked for more time and was rebuffed.
Well, do you change, public interest advocates change their tactics at all when you have a kind of, I would say, a hostile FCC, you know, do you move to the courts more? Is there anything in your approach that needs to change when you're faced with an FCC like this?
Well, I think our vision of what we want to see for the future remains unchanged. We want everyone in this country to be able to connect and communicate, no matter their income levels, no matter who they are. Our tactics, I mean, will continue to be at the forefront, filing comments, filing appeals when necessary. I do think the court system comes into play sometimes a little bit more when there's a hostile administration, as you put it. But I think really the advocacy and having people, real people, stand up from outside the beltway and give these industry insiders a reality check. And when I say industry insiders, I mean, you know, the lobbyists, but I also mean Ajit Pai, who's a former Verizon lobbyist. We really need to stand up and let our voices be heard, both to our representatives in Congress, but also to the FCC directly. We can't let this become an invisible agency that sinks under the radar. And the activism works. It's incredible that that's what we saw in net neutrality, and that's even what we're seeing now, that our voices are making a difference and making it more difficult for them and in the administration to undo all of the important consumer protections that we've fought so hard for.
We've been speaking with Jessica Gonzalez, Deputy Director and Senior Counsel at the group Free Press. You can find them online at freepress.net. Jessica Gonzalez, thank you so much for joining us this week on Counterspin.
Thank you, Janine. It was great to be here.
And that's it for Counterspin for this week. Counterspin is produced by FAIR, the National Media Watch Group based in New York. For more information about FAIR, you can check out our website, fair.org. The show is engineered by Alex Noyes. I'm Janine Jackson. Thanks for listening to Counterspin.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, Radio Eco Shop.
This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
Do you want a nice green world full of solar panels and wind machines? So do I, but as we're about to find out, that isn't going to be easy, if it's possible at all. Of course, trying to survive in a climate wrecked by fossil fuels may not be possible either. Richard Heinberg is our guest, and he's known around the world as an energy expert. He's a leader and senior fellow at the Post-Carbon Institute. He's the author of 13 books and a returning guest on Radio EcoShock. So when I got his newest book, written with David Fridley from the Berkeley Lab, I expected a triumphant plan for our transition to renewable energy in that post-carbon world. I was a little surprised, and we're all in for big surprises about how hard this change is going to be. It's all in the new book, Our Renewable Future, Laying the Path for 100% Clean Energy. It was published in June 2016. Richard Heinberg, welcome back to Radio EcoShock.
Thank you, Alex. It's always a pleasure to talk with you.
I suppose I shouldn't be shocked. Richard, you're known for taking a hard and doubtful look at things like oil reserves and coal industry hype. Now you're digging into the realities of renewables. First of all, who is your co-author and what does he contribute to this discussion?
Well, David Fridley is a staff scientist at the Energy Analysis Program at Lawrence Berkeley National Laboratories. In his job, he's worked primarily with the government of China to assess and help design their national energy plan. And a lot of that has to do with renewable power. He's recently worked with the government of China and Rocky Mountain Institute, specifically on energy efficiency and renewable energy. So I would say David is the number one expert in the United States on Chinese energy and one of our top experts on energy planning and specifically as that relates to renewable power.
Well, that's good news that you got him on board to work with you. Now, as you discuss in your book, this whole green dreaming world felt empowered when Professor Mark Jacobson of Stanford wrote an article in Scientific American way back in 2009. Jacobson said we can make that switch to alternative energy by 2050, and I interviewed Mark in late 2014. He felt even more certain it's all possible. What's your take on the Jacobson plan?
Well, it is. A transition to all renewable energy certainly is possible. We don't want to suggest that it isn't. However, it's not just a matter of building lots of solar panels and wind turbines, and Jacobson's plans mostly have to do with supply side. How do we supply enough renewable energy? What David Fridley and I did was look at the overall energy system, not just how we produce energy, but also how we use it. And that does present some daunting challenges, which Mark Jacobson mentions from time to time in his various proposals, but doesn't explore very deeply. Sometimes the devil is in the details, and we were looking at things like making cement. It doesn't sound like a very big thing, but cement is the main ingredient in concrete, which in turn is really the foundation of our physical civilization. Large buildings, highways, landing strips for aircraft, on and on. Without concrete, you know, it would be very difficult for us to construct and repair the world that we are used to inhabiting. Well, making cement is extremely energy intensive. It requires temperatures of about 1,500 degrees Celsius. And it would theoretically be possible to supply that kind of high heat with renewable energy, either with fuels made from renewable electricity, hydrogen, and other kinds of fuels, or directly with concentrated sunlight. It's possible to achieve those kinds of high temperatures with focused sunlight. But it's very likely that the process would be considerably more expensive, maybe 2-3 times as expensive as the current cement production process. And we have no demonstration projects. We don't even know how easy or difficult it would be or how expensive it would be because we're not even trying to do it that way. So this is a problem we ran into again and again with industrial processes and many transport modes. the substitutes where they would be available would likely not be drop-in substitutes. They would require research and development, and in many cases would probably be considerably more expensive than processes that we're currently using.
Well, you know, one of the questions I get all the time, Richard, is can we produce and then reproduce solar panels and wind machines without fossil fuels?
Well, that's another question. Currently, we are using fossil fuels to produce, as you say, solar panels and wind turbines. Theoretically, the process could be electrified, but we're talking about a process with many steps that starts with extraction of raw materials. Currently, the way we mine using giant mining machines that run mostly on diesel fuel, it's hard to imagine that being electrified. It's, you know, theoretically, it might be possible using electrical power produced on site and transmitted to these huge earth-moving machines via cables. Certainly, they're not going to be able to be run on batteries, but perhaps using cables, it might be possible. But again, you know, we weren't able to identify any pilot projects. And then that's just one step in the process of making wind turbines and solar panels. And you get all the way to the process of installation. With wind turbines, of course, there, we go right back to the question we talked about earlier, the need for concrete. Very large amounts of concrete are used in anchoring wind turbines in place. So, you know, from the materials through high heat industrial processes all the way to delivery and installation, there are lots of challenges in producing, installing, transporting renewable energy devices using only renewable energy. And that's one of the reasons we brought up in our book the question of how are we going to use our remaining fossil fuels? Because we're going to install enough renewable energy capacity to forestall the worst of climate impacts, we're going to have to put up wind turbines and solar panels many times faster than we're currently doing it, at least 10 times faster, maybe 20 times as fast. And that will mean a lot of resource extraction, transportation, high heat industrial processes that, at least in the early to mid phases, will have to be powered by fossil fuels. So aren't we going to have to do a kind of triage where we reduce our consumption of fossil fuels for all the other things we're doing, like, you know, flying to Las Vegas for the weekend, and deliberately devote our remaining fossil fuels to the energy transition?
Yeah, you know, it calls up so many different questions from that. It's hard to know where we can go. I mean, just another example, you talked about cement. Let's talk about plastic. Everything seems to be made out of plastic now when I go to the store. Can we make plastic at all without fossil fuels?
Well, yes. There are a number of plastics now being produced using corn and other biological materials. The problem is that most of those plastics, many of which are biodegradable and could be used in a lot of packaging. The problem is that we use plastics also for purposes where we need really high performance values in medical technology, in automobiles and aircraft and so on. We need plastics that are extremely durable, heat resistant, that will withstand impacts and so on. And so far, the kinds of bioplastics that are currently available don't meet those kinds of stringent performance requirements. So one of the roadblocks we came up against was specifically in the area of pharmaceuticals. We spoke with an expert in that area who is very sympathetic to the idea of the energy transition. But he was scratching his head and saying, well, you know, look, there aren't any good substitutes right off the bat for fossil fuels as feedstocks in making pharmaceuticals. So aren't we going to have to just, you know, reduce our use of fossil fuels for energy production and save them for things like this where, you know, we just don't have any good substitutes?
You are listening to Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith. My guest is senior fellow at the Post-Carbon Institute, Richard Heinberg. We're talking about his new book, Our Renewable Energy Future. Well, we won't have time to go into everything, all the stuff you cover in the book. It's dizzying, the asphalt, the chemicals, the roads, the paint. It just goes on. But the hardest hurdle I think, is getting fossil fuels out of agriculture. Richard Heinberg, would you care to tell our listeners some of the many places that oil, gas, and coal end up producing food for us?
Right. Well, it's not all just about diesel fuel for tractors. In fact, direct use in agriculture of fossil fuels is not the largest use of fossil fuels in our food system as a whole. It turns out that food processing is the biggest single area of energy use. And packaging is also very large. Transportation is another slice of the pie. And when you add them all together, we're using about 12 calories of fossil fuel energy to produce each calorie of food energy. So transitioning all these aspects of our food system is going to be a big job. We need to localize our food systems as much as realistically possible in order to reduce transport energy, reduce processing of food as much as possible. So we're buying foods that are less processed. Part of that processing occurs in the home, processing and storage of food in your refrigerator and on your stove. So having as efficient machines for this as possible is important, but also, you know, we have a lot of natural gas-powered stoves all across the country in people's homes, and one part of the energy transition is going to be just folks trading out their natural gas stoves for electric stoves, because we're going to have to electrify as much of our energy usage as possible in the transition. So you look at the food system as a whole, there are lots of moving parts, and we're going to have to electrify as much of it as possible. But I also want to mention the opportunity in agriculture, because up to this point, agriculture has been a huge source of greenhouse gas emissions, not only in the energy we use for all these purposes we've discussed, but also in the CO2 that's released from the soil as we degrade soil with ordinary industrial agricultural practices, tillage, application of pesticides, herbicides, and so on. We're basically killing the soil, and as the soil dies, it releases CO2 into the atmosphere. We have the opportunity to reverse that process. Lots of research has gone on in recent years in agroecology, whereby we develop and renew topsoil. We increase the biological activity of topsoil. And in doing so, we can actually capture and sequester very large amounts of CO2 from the atmosphere. So by transitioning our food system, we could not only make it more amenable to renewable energy inputs and reduce energy consumption in that, also actually reduce the amount of CO2 in the atmosphere by very substantial amounts.
And, of course, this ties into the most unpopular problem of all, expanding human population. Can we sustain over 7 billion or more people without fossil fuels? And if not, are you suggesting strict social control of reproduction or a mass die-off or what?
Well, we did include a section in the book on population because we thought it was important to address the subject. It's going to be extremely difficult to supply the energy that the world currently is using from all renewable energy inputs. In fact, we think it's extremely unlikely that world energy will be able to remain at current levels or certainly to grow over future decades using only renewable energy inputs. So that raises the question of population. You know, if population is growing but energy isn't, that would mean on a per capita basis we'd have ever less energy to work with. And energy is really at the core of everything we do. So that's really a pretty stark future to imagine. But if population were declining, then all of the problems that we're talking about would suddenly become much easier to solve. If we can reduce energy per capita in a way that doesn't take away basic human requirements, that still meets basic human needs, and also reduce population, we could arrive at a situation where our energy needs are relatively easily met by renewable sources. The biggest problem that David Fridley and I identified in transitioning to the renewable future is the problem of scale. Just the vast scale of energy usage that humanity is accustomed to currently, much less what we would need if population grows and per capita usage continues to grow. That problem of scale dogs every challenge that we identified in the industrial sector and transportation and food everywhere. Scale is the biggest problem.
So, Richard, in your new book, you and David Fridley have a whole chapter on energy and justice. Why can't we just stick with solutions technology and leave all this lefty social engineering out of the plans?
Well, the reality is energy justice is already a huge issue in the world. If you look at a graph, which we reproduce in the book, of energy usage per capita and rich and poor, they align almost perfectly. If you have lots of energy available, you're able to do a lot more. So we have a world in which economic inequality is growing. And we're talking about making an enormous energy transition. How is that transition going to impact inequity? Well, it could, in fact, actually make matters worse because it's going to cost a lot to transition to renewable energy. And if only the people with lots of money can afford to make that transition, then what we end up with at the end of the day is a few people with plenty of energy and everybody else with either dysfunctional energy systems or no energy systems to speak of. So the way we are going to get around that, I think, is with more not only distributed generation, but distributed ownership of generation. We will need cooperative and community-owned energy systems. And the only way to get there is to design from the get-go, design the process, the economic process as well as the physical process of making the energy transition as one where ownership is in the hands of the people who use that energy.
And you have another chapter for all the issues people think you should have covered, the questions that always come up at public forums on energy transition. Let's just quickly tackle two of them. First, why don't you join James Hansen to call for more nuclear power as a way to avoid horrible climate change?
Well, the reason is we don't think that's a practical alternative. The only places in the world where nuclear power is growing are China and maybe a few other nations, India. But elsewhere, nuclear power is on the way out, and we think for good environmental and economic reasons. It's expensive and it's risky. And that's not just the judgment of environmentalists. Increasingly, it's the judgment of national governments, which have had to subsidize nuclear power for decades now. And those subsidies really haven't paid off. So we don't see nuclear power as a realistic alternative to renewables. So what we decided to do in our book is make it a thought exercise entirely around renewable energy. Yes, it's likely that in 20 or 40 years, there will still be a certain percentage of world energy coming from nuclear power. But for the purposes of our thought exercise, we excluded that.
And you do talk about changes at the consumer end, and I wonder, are people really willing to give up all their energy slaves and the freedom to fly to Las Vegas for the weekend, as you say? I mean, is that making America great again?
Well, in our view, there simply is no other way forward. We have an energy system currently that relies mostly on fossil fuels for about 85% of our energy. And that's simply an unsustainable energy system. And when I say unsustainable, I don't mean it's insufficiently eco-groovy. I mean that we can't keep doing this much longer. We're already seeing a global oil industry that's in the throes of near collapse simply because the best prospects are gone. All of our new oil production prospects are in really expensive areas like the tight oil in North Dakota and South Texas, the tar sands in Canada, deep water oil, Arctic oil, and so on. The good stuff is gone, and what's left is going to be very expensive to produce, and the economy just can't bear oil prices that high. A similar thing, everywhere you look in fossil fuel industries, natural gas, coal, it's not as though we're running out of these fuels, but we are running out of the cheaply, easily accessed fuels, and that means that as time goes on, it's going to become harder, more expensive, and more environmentally risky to continue relying on these fuels. So if we do that, if we don't deliberately make a transition to renewable energy, what we will see is, you know, we will be giving up those energy perks, the trips to Las Vegas and all the rest, but we'll be doing it with no alternative.
So I'm thinking of compiling a list, maybe 25 things we can do personally to help prevent catastrophic climate change. And what would be the top five items on that list as far as you're concerned?
I think one would be doing a personal energy audit, just looking at your own life to see how you're using energy, not just in electricity, because electricity is only about 20% of all the energy that we use. So looking at energy that you use in the food that you consume, in transportation, in packaging, in the stuff you buy, and see where you can make the most difference. Many people find that cutting out air travel is the single biggest thing they can do to reduce their greenhouse gas emissions. And, you know, just by doing that one thing, making a personal energy audit, you can basically fill out that list of the five biggest things.
Why did you write this book, Richard?
Well, you know, more and more people are talking now about the renewable energy transition, and we think that's a very good thing. But we felt that it was really important for the discussion to get beyond just how many solar panels and how many wind turbines do we need. Energy transitions in history, you know, the discovery of fire, the agricultural revolution, the industrial revolution, which really should be called the fossil fuel revolution. Energy transitions are overwhelming transformations of society that usually end up transforming not just food systems and transportation, but political systems, economic systems, how people think about the world, people's daily lives. We think we're on the cusp of something just as transformative now, but the conversation is still pretty one-dimensional. We wanted to start to add some dimensionality to that conversation so that the people can begin to prepare and think realistically about what's ahead. And hopefully policymakers can do the same.
Where do people go to find out more about your new book?
Well, the best place folks can go is ourrenewablefuture.org. We have a wonderful website for the book, which has the entire contents of the book, plus a lot of material that isn't in the physical printed book. Obviously, we're happy for people to buy the physical book, but we think this information is important enough that we want folks to have access to it, whether they can afford to buy the book or not. So go to the website, and you'll find everything you want.
We've been talking to one of the best guides to a post-carbon world, author and energy analyst Richard Heinberg. His latest of 13 books is just out this June 2016. It's called A Renewable Future, Laying the Path for 100% Clean Energy. I thought I might just skim through it, to be honest, but I ended up reading it cover to cover. It's that good. Richard, thank you so much for talking with us on Radio EcoShock.
Well, thank you, Alex. It's always a pleasure.
I'm Alex Smith. Basic life forms of the ocean are the source of most of the oxygen we breathe. Are they in deep trouble? Did you know plankton can affect the development of clouds? Another surprise in the climate story. We're talking about plankton and climate change with Dr. Michael Barenfeld. He's a senior research scientist and professor at Oregon State University. Mike specializes in marine algae research. Barenfeld is also the principal investigator for a special five-year NASA project called NAMES, with two A's, the North Atlantic Aerosols and Marine Ecosystems Study. Mike, thank you so much for joining us on Radio EcoShock.
My pleasure. Thank you.
I've kind of developed a grab bag of questions about plankton, and you're the guy, so let's take a shot at it and see how far we can get. For those new to plankton, maybe we should start with the most common misconception. People say to me, show me a plankton, like show me a tiger or something. What does plankton really mean?
Plankton, basically the word is derived from a term meaning free-floating. And there are two basic categories we think about most often in the plankton, although there's a couple more. We think about the zooplankton, which are the essentially zoo meaning animals. They're this very small animals that are free-floating in aquatic systems in the ocean and lakes. And there are phytoplankton, phyto meaning light. These are essentially the plants of the ocean. They're microscopic. There's also bacteria, plankton, and viruses. And these make up most of the plankton.
And then we talk about a plankton bloom. What is their normal state, and then what is a bloom?
Okay, a plankton bloom it's basically a high concentration of phytoplankton. And along with a high concentration of phytoplankton, you also have higher concentrations of the other plankton, the zooplankton, and the bacteria, and the viruses. It's a bit of a relative term. You know, we often might be driving along a road and go by a pond in the summertime, and the pond is green. We would say that, oh, that's a phytoplankton bloom. But more of the question is about basically the process of blooming. So the process of blooming means that the concentration of phytoplankton is going from a relatively low level to a higher level. And the largest phytoplankton bloom on the planet occurs in the North Atlantic, and that's where the NAMES study is focused.
Why would NASA be interested in plankton blooms in the North Atlantic Ocean?
Wow, great question. One of the hopes, of course, is that the bloom in the North Atlantic, if we can understand that bloom, it will tell us about blooms all over the world. Hopefully the fundamental processes are similar. NASA's interested in this because phytoplankton and the zooplankton and others that eat them are the base of marine food webs. They feed our fisheries. They interact with the atmosphere. Phytoplankton take up a lot of the nutrients that get dumped into the ocean from rivers. And they also take up CO2, carbon dioxide, from the atmosphere. And NASA has actually been studying phytoplankton from space for many years, which is kind of an interesting concept to think of, that you're looking from space at things that you can't even see with your eye, these tiny little phytoplankton. But what they do is when you have more and more phytoplankton in the water, it changes the color of the water, kind of like what I said just a minute ago. You're driving down the road, you see a pond, and it's green. Well, that's because the phytoplankton are selectively absorbing different colors of light, but not very good at absorbing the green light, which is why the pond turned green. So basically, that's what the satellite is doing. It's looking at the color of the ocean. And so what NASA is interested in is being able to study the phytoplankton globally using the satellite sensors and to understand better how the phytoplankton annual cycles develop, what drives them, how they're related to the environment, the physical environment, and ultimately inform us about how the health of these planktonic ecosystems is related to the climate of the planet.
So aside from the satellites, what other tools does the NAMES project use to track these tiny life forms?
Yes, that's a good question. We're actually using a lot of different tools. The NAMES project involves ship measurements. So we have over 30 scientists going out on ships, a ship, four times over the project, studying different parts of the annual cycle. When we're on the ship, we deploy what are called autonomous floats, and these are really great devices. They go up and down in the water column autonomously, and they measure plankton properties, and they can be out there for multiple years. So after the ship leaves, we have these floats that continue the measurements for multiple years, so we can follow what happens after we have left a certain area. And studied it intensely. And then coupled with the ship measurements and the float measurements, we also have an airplane. It's a NASA C-130 Hercules, and there's a number of scientists on the airplane that are doing measurements with remote sensing instruments as well as measurements of actual direct sampling of the air. And the remote sensing measurements are an ocean color sensor, very much like what we fly in space. There's a LIDAR on the aircraft, and the LIDAR is basically a pulsing laser, and it allows us to make measurements of properties in the atmosphere as a function of the height of those properties in the atmosphere, and it also looks into the ocean and can tell us about the structure of the plankton from the surface of the ocean down to depth. And then we also have a third remote sensing instrument on there that's a polarimeter, and what it's looking at is effects of atmospheric constituents on the polarization of sunlight, essentially. I think a lot of people are familiar with the idea of polarized light when they buy polarized sunglasses.
Okay, now could you, Mike Barenfeld, please explain for us how the plankton life cycle could affect the development of clouds?
Good question. Very interesting story. So a little bit about clouds. So clouds can't form on their own, I guess you could say, without the help of aerosols. So if you just have a lot of water vapor in the air, it won't necessarily form a cloud because that water vapor has to condense around a nucleus, okay? And that nucleus is a particle, a very small particle. We're talking about particles in the size range of, about 100 nanometers or so to about a micron. And the properties of the cloud are dependent upon the abundance of these nuclei, these particles, these aerosols. And in parts of the planet, the amount of aerosols that are in the troposphere actually limits the ability of the cloud to form. And over the open ocean, certain parts of the open ocean, the abundance of those aerosols is linked to properties of the plankton. So over the course of the annual cycle, phytoplankton do their photosynthesis and they grow, they get eaten by things, and then the waste products get processed by bacteria. And through the process of wind and wave action and bubble formation, bubble bursting at the surface, these little organic molecules get released to the atmosphere and lofted up in the boundary layer, and then they can start interacting with clouds and functioning as condensation nuclei for the water vapor.
So the million-dollar question for me is, would plankton-related clouds be important enough to change the Sun-Earth energy balance? That is, can this affect climate change?
Absolutely. So like I was saying, the properties of clouds are related to the amount of aerosols that you have. If you have very few aerosols, very few of these condensation nuclei, each one of those nuclei will collect a lot of water around it. So you form clouds with large droplets, and those tend to be darker clouds. If you have a lot of aerosols, then the droplets tend to be smaller. Those tend to be brighter clouds. So brighter clouds reflect more of the sunlight energy back into space. So the brighter the cloud, the more cooling effect it has on the climate.
Now, as you know, various countries have tried stimulating plankton blooms to study carbon capture, and then a citizen named Russ George worked with the Haida Nation off Canada's west coast. They dumped over a ton of iron into the ocean, and Russ George claims a plankton bloom did result. What are your thoughts, Mike, on such experiments?
I think that the original iron enrichment experiments that were conducted were focused on the basic scientific questions of what limits the stocks of phytoplankton in the ocean. They were not focused on so much a manipulation of ocean ecosystems for carbon sequestration. In fact, I was involved in one of the first of those. It was called IronX2, which took place in the equatorial Pacific. And some of the interest in that work was, if you have populations of phytoplankton that are limited by iron, their health, their basic physiology, is different than if they're limited by something else, light or nitrogen or phosphorus. And trying to understand what parts of the ocean are limited by iron versus other factors was a very important scientific quest. And it even has a role in our way of interpreting the satellite data. There's been a lot of heated discussions about the utility of this iron fertilization for carbon sequestration, a lot of meetings about it. And there's a lot of literature out there about pros and cons on doing such a thing. I think we have to think about, we always have to think about in such manipulations of natural ecosystems beyond just the immediate goal. So, you know, what are the impacts of causing a bloom? Well, you might have more phytoplankton biomass, which might take up more CO2, but what's the fate of that? What kind of phytoplankton are going to bloom? Can we even predict that? Are they going to be a harmful species? Are they going to be a beneficial species? What are the longer-term ramifications on the food web? And what happens after the initial bloom? So there's, you know, it's a complicated story, and unless we look at all of the nuances of the consequences of such manipulations, I think that they're probably not well advised.
You're listening to EcoShock Radio for the world.
I'm Alex Smith. Get it all at our website, ecoshock.org. You are listening to Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith with my guest, Dr. Michael Barenfeld, a plankton specialist with Oregon State University and a NASA project called NAMES. In the previous Radio EcoShock show, I talked with scientists Peter Brewer and John Shepard about research into oxygen reduction in the oceans as the seas warm. Is that a real concern for plankton?
The oxygen reductions, I didn't listen to that radio show. I'm sure that Peter probably filled you in with lots of details on that. There are changes in oxygen minima zones in the ocean. They tend to be deeper than the sunlit photic zone or the phytoplankton are.
That's right. Actually, he did mention that it was further down that they're finding, you know, without enough oxygen.
Yeah. So what's happening, of course, is that you have photosynthesis going on in the surface by the phytoplankton, and then some of that organic carbon that they form is not recycled in the surface and is exported or sinks down to deeper depths, and then it gets utilized by other organisms that use up the oxygen while they're using up the carbon. And so that's why you get this separation between the photosynthesis at the surface and these deeper oxygen minima zones.
And, you know, I've read stories that global plankton are in decline, some say up to 40% loss. Where are we with that? Is global plankton in decline?
The best record that we have about the global state of the phytoplankton is satellite data. Satellites give us that true global view. It's really hard to make a global assessment with ships or just measurements from a dock or something like that. What we see in the satellite record so far, which started in 1978, and there was a gap until 97, and then from 97 to the present, we've had continuous measurements. What we see is that the variations, if you look at the globe as a whole, that variations in the phytoplankton currently are dominated by what appears to be natural variations in climate. So El Nino, La Nina transitions tend to have a very large global footprint. And we can see that and relate it to those kinds of climate fluctuations, oscillations in the Pacific and the Atlantic, et cetera. Teasing out an anthropogenic component of that is very complex. So I don't think that there is, from a globally integrated perspective, a definitive study showing or distinguishing the natural variability from the anthropogenic variability. Now, that being said, when you start looking at regional variations, the regional variations tend to be much stronger. And so that we do see trends not only in the abundance of phytoplankton, but also the organisms that are dominating during different times of the year. So when you start looking more regionally, the interannual changes tend to be larger, and they not only include changes in the total, they also include changes in the players.
And what about ocean temperature? I mean, some parts of the ocean, say around Australia or closer to your study area in New England, have been abnormally hot in recent years. What effect does that have on plankton?
It's a complex question, actually. The answer to it is complex, I'm sorry. So temperature has both direct and indirect effects on plankton. There are direct metabolic effects on plankton, but there are also indirect effects. And what I mean by that is that if you warm the surface of the ocean, that influences the ability of nutrients deeper depths to get into the surface area where the phytoplankton are growing. It also influences how much light the surface phytoplankton see. And so the indirect effects on the nutrient supply and the light supply that the phytoplankton experience is probably, or is almost certainly, the greater consequence of the temperature changes. And so we see this very clearly in the satellite data, that we can look at the relationship between phytoplankton abundance and sea surface temperature. And when we look at the changes in those two properties, we see that we generally have a reduction in the photosynthetic pigments that the phytoplankton have when temperatures warm, and when temperatures cool, those pigments go up. And that pigment response is a reflection of nutrient availability and how much light the cells are seeing. So to be a little more specific, when a phytoplankton, holding all other things constant, when a phytoplankton sees more nutrients, it gets greener because it's growing faster. It needs to collect more light, just like a plant in your house would. If they see more light for a given amount of nutrients, they get less green, okay, because they need less pigment to absorb the energy that they need from the sun if there's more sunlight. Okay, so you have a trade-off between these two things. So what we see from the satellite clearly is that when there's warming of the surface ocean, the pigment goes down, and that pigment signal is both an effect of nutrients and effect of light.
I think another NASA press release suggested that plankton will thrive closer to the poles as the globe warms and perhaps dwindle around the tropics. Would you agree with that?
Again, that comes back to the basic question of the limitations of light and nutrients. And so I think that probably what was being suggested there is that toward the tropics, the phytoplankton tend to be persistently limited by nutrients. And if you warm the surface, it just makes it harder and harder for nutrients to get to the surface. In the higher latitudes, for large portions of the year, nutrients are pretty high in their concentrations, and light is the limiting thing. So if you're warming those waters, it's possible that the phytoplankton near the surface are actually experiencing more light, so they would have a faster division rate. Now, one of the other things that we always should keep in mind when thinking about these blooms or these abundances of phytoplankton is that the abundance of phytoplankton is not just dependent upon how fast the phytoplankton are growing. It's also dependent upon how fast they're being eaten. So it truly is an ecology problem. And the way I like to explain this to people sometimes is if you look at your lawn, you can't tell how fast the lawn is growing by how tall your grass is. Right? Because it depends on how fast it's growing and how often you're mowing it. Does that make sense?
It does.
Okay, so the same thing with the phytoplankton. When you're looking at the stalks of the phytoplankton, it's the net effect that you're looking at between how fast the phytoplankton are growing and how quickly they're being eaten. And so it always is an ecological problem, not just a problem of light and nutrients.
It is really mind-blowing, Mike, to look at photos from space satellites at those blooms. They look like artwork. And almost the size of European countries, how big do they get and how fast can they develop?
Wow, great question as well. So how big can they get? The North Atlantic bloom, as I mentioned before, is the largest bloom over spatially anywhere on the planet. And it starts from about New England, 45 degrees latitude-ish, New England, England, and goes up to the pole. And the bloom reaches its peak in early May to June, July, and it goes, the peak is earlier to the south, and it's delayed as you go further to the north, of course, following light and temperature changes. Is that what you wanted to know?
Yes. I also wanted to know sort of how fast that can happen. I mean, are we talking weeks or months or?
Yeah. So this is actually a very interesting question, and it's one of the driving science questions for the NAMES project. So the traditional view of the North Atlantic bloom was that the bloom started in the spring, and it was kind of like the greening of trees on land, right? So if you live in a deciduous forest, we know that every spring, in the wintertime, the landscape is brown, and in the spring, all of a sudden, the trees start throwing these leaves. Why is that? Well, the reason for that is that the trees are monitoring the temperature and light conditions, and when they get the right cues, it says, okay, it's time for us to start throwing leaves. So, in other words, it's driven by light and temperature. And then you get the full leaving in the summer. And traditionally, we've thought that, well, that's probably what's going on in the ocean, that you have some critical light and temperature condition, and that's when the bloom starts. Well, interestingly, once we started having satellites that could look at this ocean all the time, in other words, all year long, normally we send our ships out when the conditions are better. But with a satellite, it doesn't get seasick, so, it can actually watch what happens in the winter. And what we've recently discovered is that, in fact, the blooming period in the North Atlantic starts in the winter, and it comes to an end when the division rate, the growth conditions, are at their peak. Okay, and that's kind of strange. It's like saying that trees start throwing their leaves in winter and they drop their leaves when they get to the best time in early summer. And so one of the questions we have is, well, what could possibly drive that? Why would we see that in the North Atlantic? And why is it so different than on the terrestrial system? So getting back to your question, what that means is that the blooming phase of the plankton annual cycle in the North Atlantic starts in December-ish, and it lasts until June. So it lasts for many, many months. So that's kind of the speed of this. Now, over the course of that period, you have periods where they start declining again, and then they come up again. So it's not just this constant blooming. It's going up and down and up and down, and that's tied to the physical environment, light and storms and things like that. So you can have short-term bursts, which only last for a few days, for a few weeks, but the whole blooming event takes place over the course of many, many months.
And I've heard hints from scientists that warming could favor bacteria that actually eat plankton or destroy plankton. Can this balance be kept, or is it possible that something terrible could happen to the plankton?
Well, that's a big question. So as I mentioned when we first started talking, you know, one of our hopes with this project is to better understand this control, this annual cycle of the plankton bloom. And understanding that is not just about how fast they're growing, as I mentioned before, because there's also the things that kill them. You have zooplankton, viruses, and bacteria. And so understanding how that link, this basically it's a question of predator-prey relationships. How is that intimate food web of the plankton tied to the environmental conditions? Why do we get a bloom every year in the North Atlantic? And why is it different some years? Why is it lower one year and higher in another? Trying to understand that is really a core of this project. And that comes down to fundamental questions of losses of the phytoplankton to the bacteria you're talking about, but also to the grazers and to the viruses.
As a last sort of question, I'm going to open it up to you to say anything you like in just a minute. But before that, supposing in a coming decade the international community recognizes that plankton are in serious trouble, is there anything we could do about it, or is this a massive system well beyond any human intervention?
It is definitely a massive system. So can we do anything about it? If we find that, you know, that there's a clear signature or a clear effect of climate warming on the plankton of the globe, what would be necessary is to try and slow that climate trend down in order to hopefully reverse or stop whatever trend it is that we're trying to stop, which would take a very enormous cooperative effort to do. Is there a simple fix to the problem? No, I don't think there is a simple fix to the problem. We can't just go out and seed it with something. So it's a very complex system, and if trends start happening, we have to understand, first of all, why they're happening. And I'm not sure how well we could react in a manner that would stop some trend in global plankton communities.
Right. That's kind of what I suspected. As we wrap up here, Mike Barenfeld, is there anything else that you would like to talk to our listeners about?
Yeah, so there's one thing I thought I would mention. This is kind of an interesting anecdote. So a while back, if you had asked me, you know, what is the influence of phytoplankton on clouds, I would have been skeptical if there was one. And then I started learning about the research that was being done about this influence of ocean biology on atmospheric aerosols. And these are aerosols that are in what we call the lower boundary layer of the troposphere. That's from the surface of the ocean up to about where the base of clouds are. Okay, this is a well-mixed area. And as it turns out, there are certain parts of the global oceans where the amount of aerosols in the atmosphere is low enough that it can actually limit cloud formation. And so you might ask me, well, where are those places and why are those places? Those places are found particularly at higher latitudes and in truly open ocean areas. And what I mean by that is places in the ocean that are far away from land. So land gives off a lot of aerosols, and some of those aerosols are carried out over the ocean. But in this boundary layer, which is so important for cloud formation, this boundary layer, the lifetime of those aerosols from land is very short. It's on the order of a couple of days. And so as you get away from land, and particularly where there's common storms, rainstorms, because rain removes this from the atmosphere can become extremely clean. In other words, there's very, very low aerosols. And one of the interesting things that we did on the first NAMES cruise, which was in November of this last year, is we took a cup of coffee outside. Okay, so this is November, south of Greenland. It's cold, right? We take a cup of hot coffee out there, and guess what comes off the top of the coffee mug?
Steam?
That's what you'd expect, but there was no steam. Why is that? It's really interesting, right? You actually can go out in this freezing cold air, and you're not getting steam off of your cup. There's water vapor coming out of your cup of coffee, but there's no steam because there's so few aerosols, the steam can't form. Steam is the formation of water droplets. It's water condensing around particles. And if you take that cup of coffee and then you put a cigarette lighter up next to it and you flick the cigarette lighter provides a few aerosols. and you get a puff of steam. And it was kind of one of those moments for me scientifically where I was like, oh, I get it, right? Yes, I can see how this part of the ocean can actually be significantly influenced by the biology. There's so few aerosols up there that, you know, even though the load of aerosols coming from the ocean plankton may be small, it's a big source for that part. And yeah, you can see that, oh, this is important. This could really make a difference. And if we see changes in the plankton over time, for whatever reason, that source of aerosols to that atmosphere is going to change. And that is going to change the clouds. And that, of course, then feeds back on the climate. As we talked about, you know, the more aerosols you have, the brighter the clouds, the more they reflect, the more they cool. So it was just kind of one of those really cool, tangible examples of like, oh, yeah, I really get it. This is important.
I love that story. From Oregon State University, we've been talking with Dr. Michael Barenfeld. He is the lead scientist in a project by the National Aeronautics and Space Administration to study plankton blooms in the North Atlantic. That's the North Atlantic Aerosols and Marine Ecosystem Study, with the acronym NAMES. Find it at names.larc.nasa.gov. Or if you missed that, get links for everything in this interview in my show blog at ecoshog.info. Mike, thank you so much for your work and for sharing it with us.
Thank you, Alex, and thank you for your interest.
I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock. That seems like a good place to leave it for now. Somewhere out in the ocean, there is still air so pure, human-driven dust cannot be found. According to Michael Barenfeld, who is an acknowledged expert on satellite records of plankton, there is no evidence these essential ocean creatures are being killed off by climate change. That does run against headlines published in the Independent newspaper on July 28, 2010, titled "The Dead Sea: Global Warming Blamed for 40% Decline in the Ocean's Phytoplankton." That frightening article was based on a study published July 2010 in the journal Nature by Daniel G. Boyce and al. It's called Global Phytoplankton Decline Over the Past Century. However, there has been a reevaluation in reading satellite data on plankton. Based on the point made by Mike Barenfeld in this interview, scientists have found that when conditions warrant, phytoplankton have less color and may be harder to see. In September 2015, NASA released a study showing diatoms, the largest phytoplankton algae, have declined by more than 1% globally every year from 1998 to 2012. Most of this decline was in the Northern Hemisphere, especially in the Northern Pacific Ocean. But Dr. Barenfeld did tell us that regional declines have been found, even though there is no published evidence yet supporting a global decline of all plankton. The balance of types of plankton may also be changing. It's complicated. Remember, in my show posted January 20th, 2016, Russian-trained plankton modeler Sergei Petrovsky said we don't yet know whether plankton will thrive or die off as the oceans warm. That's still a topic of scientific study and debate. But Petrovsky also said his models show that in either case, thrive or decline, plankton reaches a crisis point in warming where a massive die-off can occur. I'll put a link to that show on my blog at ecoshock.info. But for now, I'm going with this picture of an ocean which is struggling but far from dead. That's an important part of Radio EcoShock. We have plenty to worry about. There's no doubt about our future prospects that are cloudy, if not dire. I've had dozens of scientists on the show already this year who explain why. That said, there is a tendency in the public to expect, almost hope for, the worst, and soon. Some of us are tired of the strain. We want to see the end times before our lives end. It's been that way for thousands of years, at least for Christians, who may die disappointed they didn't see the terrible battles and Christ returning. Other thoughtful people realize our civilization is a heat engine, as the Utah scientist Tim Garrett told Radio EcoShock listeners a few years ago. We eat up ancient forests, don't we, for throwaway products? We dig up radioactive rocks and make them even more concentrated and poisonous. We burn fossil fuels for entertainment. We hunt and kill rare animals and plants for fun. We can't go on as we are and still leave a working ecosystem for our descendants. That's plain. There are serious scientists who will tell you, off and off the air, that only a severe economic crash can avert a mass extinction event. All the financial signs are flashing that collapse is coming. But then, the machine so far has kept running somehow. Most of us want it to keep going. After 45 straight shows peering into the dark future, I'm more than ready for my annual vacation. It's summer in the Northern Hemisphere. It will be a working vacation for me, as I harvest our large garden and put away lots of good food for the coming winter. That's how I stay sane, if I do, and that's part of the reason I can afford to donate my time for the science and activism that is Radio EcoShock. I still need your support to help pay for free downloads of the show around the world, plus the website and other ongoing costs that keep going month after month. I'm so grateful to those who have kept me going so far. Listeners have made this program possible. Please consider either a one-time donation of any amount or becoming part of the team of subscribers who give $10 a month for Radio EcoShock. Find out how at ecoshock.org. For the next few weeks, I'll be broadcasting shows from the large archive of past interviews. I'll be picking from programs that were downloaded thousands of times by listeners, some of them tens of thousands of times. There are voices which are either reflecting our minds or challenge them deeply. Our Radio EcoShock podcast is back, by the way. You can find the show on iTunes or any other podcatcher. Find the clickable podcast icons in my show blog at ecoshock.info. Feel free to browse all our past programs, to load up your iPod, computer, or MP3 player for summer listening with our free shows, or winter in the Southern Hemisphere. People in 91 countries listen to Radio EcoShock by podcast on our SoundCloud page or directly from the website at ecoshock.org. Of course, the podcast and blog only come out after the broadcast by our 94 participating nonprofit radio stations. That's the backbone of the show, and by far our largest audience. It's in the United States, Canada, the UK, and Australia so far. I deeply appreciate the volunteers and staff who make this radio station work, mostly advertising-free, well out of the corporate lens. Frankly, at this point, only non-corporate media seems willing to risk talking about the whole truth of climate change, our energy predicament, and the peril to all creatures. Which leads me back to two last things for now. As I said, despite the real scientific warnings, we have to be wary of apocalyptic messages that are not based on evidence. Second, as Richard Heinberg reminds us, there may be a way to safety with renewable energy, but it's not going to be easy. The changes each of us need to make are fundamental and difficult. We have to do a little better with nature every day and a lot better every year. Meanwhile, I'll be watching the world news and checking new science. I may toss a new tune on SoundCloud or blast out a short YouTube video. You'll get notice of that from my Twitter feed. Sign up at EcoShock. If anything extreme blows up or something just can't wait, I may have to do a new show or two. I hope not. I'm Alex Smith. Thank you for giving me the opportunity to learn, along with you, from some of the best minds of our generation. I'll be back with more original interviews at the start of September. Until then, please stay tuned as the best of Radio EcoShock comes your way every week. We'll be right back.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, Electronic Intifada's weekly Palestine podcast.
I mean, we do have to have a multi-pronged effort, one in civil disobedience and the other in advocacy. And I think that hopefully we took the burden off the people in engaging in an act of civil disobedience, and now they can go full force and take action.
The Electronic Intifada.
The Electronic Intifada.
The Electronic Intifada.
This is the Electronic Intifada podcast.
If confirmed, I will also faithfully observe the...
David Friedman, you promote racism, fund illegal settlements. We will not be silenced. You do not represent us, and you will never represent us.
Israeli occupation is an injustice against Palestinians and a moral prejudice for American Jews. Moral American Jews stand against occupation and against Friedman.
Senator, if you send this man to Israel, you endanger millions of Palestinians and Israelis. American Jews stand against this man. We stand for freedom and dignity for all. Olam chesed yibaneh.
If confirmed by the
Senate. Discontinuous question.
Chairman Corker, Ranking Member Cardin, members of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, I appreciate very much the opportunity to appear before you today. It's a great privilege to address this committee, which has done so much to advance America's interests around the world.
Mr. Friedman also said that Palestinian refugees don't have a claim to the land, don't have a connection to Palestine, when in fact they do, Mr. Friedman. I'm right here, Mr. Friedman. My grandfather was exiled, was kicked out by the State of Israel, Mr. Friedman. And I'm right here, Mr. Friedman, holding up the Palestinian flag right behind you. We are going away, Mr. Friedman. We were there. We are there now, and we will always be there. Palestinians will always be in Palestine.
In Los Angeles this week, I'm Nora Barrows Friedman. You're listening to the Electronic Intifada podcast. Those were the voices of some of the protesters who on Thursday interrupted the Senate confirmation hearings of David Friedman, who could be the next U.S. ambassador to Israel. Friedman, an ardent Zionist who has a home in Talbiya, a neighborhood of West Jerusalem that was ethnically cleansed by Zionist forces in 1948, helped funnel tens of millions of dollars into the Bet El settlement colony in the occupied West Bank. He's called supporters of the liberal Zionist group J Street, quote, worse than capos, Jews who turned in their fellow Jews in the Nazi death camps. But as the Electronic Intifada points out, he has painted himself as a moderate. Joining us today are two of the activists who protested Friedman's hearing, Tahar Herzala of American Muslims for Palestine and Tali Ruskin of Jewish Voice for Peace and Code Pink. They're the last two voices you heard in those recordings. Tahar and Tali, thank you so much for being with us on the Electronic Intifada podcast.
Thank you, Nora. Thank you.
So, Todd, let's start with you. Tell us about your protest and why you did it.
Our protest obviously was targeted and aimed at David Friedman, but also really to the senators who are sitting on the Foreign Relations Committee to send a clear message that that youth, Palestinian and Jewish together, oppose and fervently reject the Zionist monopoly over American politics or American foreign policy, as well as the Zionist monopoly over the Jewish community and the Jewish community politics. And for me, it was very important to talk about my family history, to really center that in my protest, and I hopefully accomplish that goal.
And Tali, tell us about your action and why you're out there at the Senate confirmation hearing as well.
Great. Thanks, Nora. And thank you, Tahir. Well, I see this action as part of a huge campaign that many, many groups have been a part of to work to ensure that David Friedman not become the next U.S. ambassador to Israel. So many groups like JVP and Code Pink and AMP and countless others have been in the U.S. campaign for Palestinian rights, have been working tirelessly to make phone calls to senators and have meetings with senators to talk to them about why David Friedman would be such a terrible choice for the U.S. ambassador to Israel. So I see this action as part of that larger campaign to be vocal in the room where the Senate Foreign Relations Committee is hearing from Friedman about his what he believes to be his qualifications to be the ambassador. And many groups have said that he's not qualified. And I wanted to make sure to really voice that and bring voice to the fact that he's not qualified for this position. And furthermore, that he himself personally finances settlements and buildings within settlements. I mean, his name is featured on buildings throughout settlements in the occupied West Bank, and it would be dangerous and inappropriate for him to be the U.S. ambassador to Israel. So I wanted to really bring voice to that.
Now, Tahir, you're no stranger to protests when a representative of Israeli policies is speaking. You were one of the Irvine 11 in 2010. You protested the speech of then Ambassador Michael Oren at UC Irvine. Can you talk a little bit about this continuation of protest and why it's so important to you to remain committed to doing this kind of action?
Yeah, I think that continuing or learning from my experience in Irvine 7 years ago, I felt that this form of protest was highly effective in getting the message across to not only those who are sitting in the audience and those who are the target of our message, but also those who are watching on TV or over video. And I think that it's very important for us in this era, in particular in the Trump era, that we recognize that this is the protest era, that we recognize that there's nothing normal about this and that we have to stand up and make a stand. And so for me, that this was a tactical decision. I think the group that was organizing Tali headed the process of organizing this demonstration, and I'm fully grateful for that. And those from If Not Now and Kareem from AMP deliberately thought about what to do. And I think this was a very important strategic decision to protest in this way. And I'm still very, very committed to this type of protest and the efficiency of this type of protest and getting the word out and taking the mic when we typically don't have the mic ourselves.
And you both spent time in jail in Washington, D.C. After you were escorted out of the hearing room. Can you talk a little bit about what that was like and if charges are being filed against you?
So we were arrested immediately after the event. We were taken down to a police van, stuffed in there, and then driven to this command center, the Capitol Police Command Center, where we were jailed for several hours while being processed and booked. And I believe most of us got booked for unlawfully disrupting Congress or something of that sort. And so we are awaiting a court date, some of us are, to see if we will officially be charged by the prosecutor. But that we'll find that out on March 1st when some of us go to court.
So the court hearings are on March 1st. And Tali, does that apply to you as well?
Well, I was actually one of the later people who was being processed. So by the time they got to me, they somehow, I think they changed the charges. I'm not really sure what happened because there was a lot of commotion, but essentially I was able to pay a fine of $35, and another person who was processed at the same time as me from It's Not Now was able to pay a fine of $50. I'm not sure why we had different charges, but so we do not have a court date on March 1st.
Finally, both of you, Tahar, brought up the fact that this is the age of protest. What comes next?
You know, I think that one of the main reasons to do an action of this sort of civil disobedience and disruption during a Senate hearing is to get attention, but not for the sake just for the sake of getting attention, but this for the sake of using that attention to propel people to take further action. So next week, Congress will be on recess. So people's senators will be at home in their district offices. And so this is the time for folks to set up meetings with their senators in their local offices to tell them to vote against Friedman. This action is really to be used as a wake-up call, as, you know, sort of a flashy moment to get people to take action on this issue. Like I said, this action is part of a much larger campaign to ensure that David Friedman not become the U.S. ambassador to Israel. So I think that the next step is that we need to really leverage this moment to make sure that people voice their opposition to Friedman to their elected officials.
And Tahar.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. I think, as Tali said, this is hopefully a catalyst for people to move from being, bystanders to active participants. And I think this is what we're hoping for, is that people seriously take a look at the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, see if their senator is on that committee, and immediately make phone calls. I mean, we do have to have a multi-pronged effort, one in civil disobedience and the other in advocacy. And I think that hopefully we took the burden off the people in engaging in an act of civil disobedience, and now they can go full force and take action in advocacy and calling and sending letters and meeting with their elected officials to reject the appointment of David Friedman. Absolutely.
All right. Well, Tahar Herzella and Tali Ruskin, both of you, thank you so much for being with us on the Electronic Intifada podcast.
Thank you, Nora, and thank you so much, Tahar.
Thank you all.
And that's it for the Electronic Intifada podcast. For news, information, cultural features and reviews, and pointed opinion and analysis, visit us online at electronicintifada.net, where you can also post comments and sign up for our daily email digest. Follow us on Twitter at Intifada. Radio stations are free to use this podcast, and if you're listening on iTunes, support the Electronic Intifada podcast by rating it and leaving a review. On behalf of all of us at the Electronic Intifada, thank you for listening.
Welcome to the Taylor Report, CIUT 89.5 FM. I'm Phil Taylor, your host. Phil Conlon is here. How are you doing, Phil?
Yes, good afternoon, Phil.
We are going to speak to Zafar Bengash at about 5:30, we think. Zafar Bengash is crescent-online.net, and we're going to get his comments on the Quebec attack on the Quebec mosque, and also his thoughts about developments in the Middle East, which, by the way, we understand are related matters. We'll be speaking also shortly with Ann Garrison in California. And she has written two articles, one article that is in Counterpunch. It has two themes about it. It's very relevant to all the demonstrations and activities that are going on in response to decisions by the current president. The title of her article in Counterpunch, published January 26th, is The Women's March in Washington, D.C. as Broadcast, which is, I like, that's the part we're going to get into. Now, we do have an announcement. A good friend of CIT and of the Taylor Report and others is Tiki Mercury Clark is going to perform.
Yes, and that'll be Saturday night at the Harborfront, and it's free at 7 p.m. It's the Kumba Festival, and it's called Black in the Day, and it's kind of like growing up black in Toronto from an earlier era, and that's the theme of her show at 7 p.m. at the Harborfront Center on Saturday night, and that's free admission.
Free admission.
Yes.
And the title is Black in the Day.
Black in the Day.
And it's Tiki Mercury.
Tiki Mercury Clark. It's part of the Kumba Festival.
Yeah. And again, as the Taylor Report, I'll just say, too, that we want to congratulate Eva Bartlett on having a very successful tour of cities of North America, where she reported on her trips to Syria and also in analyzing the failures of the mainstream news. As you know, we will soon have a Ministry of Truth where we can turn in her papers and they will go and correct CNN, the Globe and Mail, Toronto Star, and New York Times and others because they're so interested in the truth. Of course, these meetings were put together by wonderful people and I would say courageous people because the tide, the ideological political tide, is running against those who want to understand what's going on in the Middle East and put a stop to the wars, regime change wars. To put it simply. And by the way, that's going to be pertinent to what we have to say with Ann Garrison, I'm sure. I think we'll have an opportunity to hear the Nobel Prize winner in literature, Bob Dylan, has a good song. We're starting to use it a little bit as to help us out in our show because it seems to be pertinent. Hard Green's going to Fall. We'll listen to a bit of that, and we'll come back with Ann Garrison.
Oh, where have you been, my blue-eyed son? And where have you been, my darling young one? Stumbled on the side of 12 misty mountains. I've walked and I've crawled on 6 crooked highways. I've stepped in the middle of 7 sad forests. I've been out in front of a dozen dead oceans. I've been 10,000 miles in the mouth of a graveyard. It's a hard, it's a hard, it's a hard, and it's a hard rains are gonna fall. And what did he see, my blue eyed son? And what did you see, my darling young one? I saw a newborn baby with wild wolves around it. Saw a highway of diamonds with nobody on it. I saw a black branch with blood that kept dripping. I saw a room full of men with their hammers bleeding. And I saw a white ladder all covered with water. I saw 10,000 talkers whose tongues were all broken. I saw guns and sharp swords in the hands of young children. And it's a hard. It's a hard, it's a hard, and it's a hard rains
are gonna fall. And what did you hear, my blue-eyed son? And what did you hear?
That's Bob Dylan, Hard Rain's Gonna Fall, and which seems to be the case, politically speaking. And we are joined now by Ann Garrison. Are you there, Ann?
Yes, I am. Hi, Phil.
Hi. It's good to be talking to you because you wrote an article in January 26, Counterpunch, titled The Women's March in Washington, D.C., as broadcast. And it seems to me it's very valuable because you're raising the issue that everybody ought to be thinking about. If they don't like American policies, domestic and foreign, and they want to do something about it, the question is, I guess, is who's leading this? And so you took a critical eye and looked at the Women's March in Washington. Of course, now there's been a second by the time, now a week or two has gone by, and now you're having massive demonstrations. I think we combine the two subjects because in the second paragraph of your article, you point out that there is this issue of the National Security Entry-Exit Registration System, which you say, are we protesting that? And you raise the matter of this seems to have been a policy going back through several presidents. So anyway, let's just start with that. What was it about the Washington March you think people ought to be thinking about?
The Washington March, as broadcast, was an obvious Democratic Party attempt to channel dissonant energy into the Democratic Party and its next attempt to take Congress and the presidency.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a dead end.
Mm-hmm.
If we don't acknowledge that the policies of Bill Clinton and Barack Obama, the neoliberalism, the predatory capitalism that has taken over our political institutions got us to this point by causing so much suffering that Trump was able to win the Electoral College, then it's just a dead end. We're not going to get anywhere beyond where we are.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I was struck. They didn't. Usually, you get a massive demonstration. American people, particularly people who consider themselves progressive or liberal, they talk about we want to avoid war. But actually, there were people in that march who rather. They had sinister suggestions and signs, and I think some of the speakers talked about, oh, we don't want Putin running our country. That's a dangerous road.
It's very dangerous, and it's like things have turned upside down. The Democratic Party is now more the war party than even the Republican Party.
Mm-hmm.
Because Trump said, I don't want to provoke a confrontation with Russia in Syria,
mm-hmm.
and said that NATO is obsolete. He said that a number of times, and that he didn't support the buildup on Europe's borders with NATO. That was a buildup that was increased in the last 2 days of Obama's presidency, meaning that we have more troops in Europe than we have since the end of the Cold War.
Yes, and Merkel sent her a convoy of Germans. That's always a happy thought, Germans heading towards the Russian border. And then, by the way, the Canadian prime minister, he sent troops. And here it's not remarked on. And that's why I think your article, by the way, is so valuable. Why aren't these things talked about?
Well, they're being talked about. Some of us are talking about it. I'm trying to be very careful to say that I don't dis the protest. With regards to the Women's March, I know there were a lot more people in the streets who had a more radical experience and had more radical intentions.
Mm-hmm.
But that particular event, especially as controlled and broadcast from the stage in Washington, was downright bizarre.
Yes.
I described that. I described in my article, I described some of the things we saw. Gloria Steinem got up and said, well, I'm old enough to remember the death of hope, and I remember when JFK and Martin Luther King and RFK and Malcolm X were assassinated. And then she said, and if that hadn't happened, we wouldn't have had some of the wars that happened later. Well, what can she possibly be talking about? These assassinations of the late 60s, early 70s had nothing to do with the Iraq war, the war in Syria, the wars in seven Muslim countries that Obama was sustaining. I mean, Obama managed to escalate, to expand two wars in Muslim countries into seven, creating millions more refugees. Mm-hmm. And we can't meaningfully, we can help the people. We can. I mean, it's wonderful that people are flocking to the airport in support of the refugees. And although some Democratic officials are going out there for photo ops at various airports, this is not a fundamentally Democratic Party staged event. And would be really grim. It would be a lot more grim than it is if these people weren't at the airport.
Yes.
But any Democratic officials who show up at these protests to have their picture taken should be booed, should be roundly booed in front of the cameras because they backed Obama's expansion of two wars in Muslim countries into seven, creating millions more refugees.
Yes, and by the way, you might have seen that article by Glenn Greenwald where he quotes a senator from Massachusetts. I think it's actually a good quote where he said, bombing a country and then saying we won't take your refugees. He says that'd make a good horror film, but it's not a foreign policy. But when he says that, he's talking about all the administrations.
I read that article.
And by the way, your article with Greenwald, by the way, if I was recommending people read something, I think they should read your article, Counterpunch, and Glenn Greenwald, because they complement each other nicely, because neither you nor Greenwald is letting the people divert themselves from the context and reality that produced the crisis that everybody's now at the airports being concerned about. Limiting states, by the way, I mean, we could argue the sanctions on Syria, the sanctions on Iran, and the calibration of this guy can come in, that one can't, as foreign policy, it's inevitably going to create terrible injustices for people who are just literally caught in the middle and trying to save their lives, you know.
Oh, yeah, and imagine the 2 million internally displaced persons in the Democratic Republic of the Congo, whom Americans are just barely aware of.
And they're certainly not going to take them in. And they were not taking them. By the way, there wasn't a great number being taken in by Obama. People were pointing out the numbers were quite small. And basically that project was closed, and they wanted the applause for having opened the door slightly to a few people.
Well, and the deportations of Rwandans continued, including Dr. Leopold Munyakazi, who was recently deported. Those deportations were intense when Bill Clinton was president. They were so intense that Madeleine Albright and Janet Reno, who was then the Attorney General, intervened to make sure that Pastor Ntakaruthi Mana was deported. Now, I don't expect everyone to understand this. I'm not criticizing people protesting about this, but about what they're protesting about now. The Rwandan and Congolese story, and the story of American aggression there in the past 20 years has been so successfully covered up by the media, that it's just unreasonable to expect large numbers of people like those now filling the airports to understand that and respond to it. But, you know, we're going to take note of it here on CIUT.
Yes, that's what we do at CIUT. You're right. And by the way, you could use the broader picture that Africans don't have a prayer in this discussion. I mean, thousands of them have died who, as a result of the bombing of Libya and the destruction of it and the economy and the victimization of Africans by the reactionaries that took over that country, people get in boats and don't make it across the Mediterranean. Everybody just shrugs. So we've got a long way to go to understand this. Now, I want to point out, you list some nice comments. There's an irony. America Ferreira spoke, and you said, you pointed out that there's a little problem with her, the way she told her story about, and endorsed Hillary. Could you tell us about that?
America Ferreira is the daughter of Honduran immigrants. She endorsed Hillary Clinton in the primary in 2008 and in 2012. The overthrow of Manuel Zelaya's government in Honduras, engineered by Secretary of State Hillary Clinton, and then the flood of refugees to our borders, including many, many children, did not change her mind. You know, I saw her speech, and when I saw it, I thought, well, she's actually pretty good. She's not as bad as the others. And then I started poking around the web to see who she was. Disappointed.
If you were standing near her, you'd want to sort of tug on her jacket and say, excuse me. this is a con. But, of course, that platform did resemble the, you know, it looked like the nomination of Hillary. But there was somebody appeared there who, in my view, is becoming more irritating by the day. But that's Michael Moore, who he did endorse Hillary after years of, being critical of the Democratic Party and even of Obama. But when it was election time, he suddenly became a passionate supporter of Hillary's. But after the defeat, he said, well, it's time to clean house. And you had a great comment on that. Tell us about your thoughts about Michael Moore's talk and what actually happened when he tried to make his point.
That was one of the great moments of the Women's March. He's up on stage and he's talking about how we have to take over the Democratic Party. And everybody out there in the audience, you have to run for office, even for Democratic Party precinct delegate. And you have to start calling your congressman every morning, make it part of your routine. And then he says, okay, and then after we take over the DNC, that's the Democratic National Committee, Ashley Judd burst in on him. The actress, and she went into this overwrought, I am a nasty woman oration. And that was in reference to a debate between Trump and Clinton in which Trump had said something like, oh, she's a nasty woman, meaning Hillary. So, and before Ashley Judd was done, she had saluted other nasty women, including not only Hillary Clinton, but also Condoleezza Rice.
Yes. Bomber-in-chief.
Yes. So it has, I think it's an aircraft carrier named after her.
Oh, my gosh. I gather from that. I wasn't watching the thing at the moment, but it does appear that they were just trying to shut him down. Somebody gave a little wink, and they got Judd started so that he couldn't go continue to rant about cleaning house at the Democratic Party, right?
He couldn't finish that sentence. He says, after we take over the Democratic Party. And, you know, instead of saying, wait a minute, Ashley, I haven't finished talking about how we're going to take over the Democratic National Committee. Instead, he tried to save face by saying, oh, my God, it's Ashley Judd. And earlier he was saying, ah, Gloria Steinem was here. I got to meet Gloria Steinem. How cool is that? That's the one who blamed the recent wars. Gloria Steinem blamed the recent wars on the assassinations of the 1960s. Mm-hmm. And just a totally incoherent speech. So
I don't, you know, I'm surprised that Steinem, well, maybe I'm not, but she did work for the CIA once, but to say that John F. Kennedy was going to end the war, he did found the Green Berets. He created them. It was his idea. And he was enthusiastic about going into Vietnam. And, of course, maybe she would remember there was a Cuban Missile Crisis when he said, victory would be ashes in our mouths, but it will be victory, when he confronting Russia.
And she has
the gall to talk about him. I was amazed. But that's what they do.
Yeah, the other thing about all these Democrats jumping on the bandwagon now about justice for the Muslim refugees and green card holders who are trying to get into the country is that they're also all, every one of them, down with this campaign against Russia, that mm-hmm. Russia stole our election. Mm-hmm. Never mind what was in the emails, in the Clinton and Podesta emails, the campaign emails. Never mind what was in the DNC emails. Mm-hmm. Let's just talk about Russia, because all this other stuff and the fact that Hillary Clinton lost to mm-hmm. a candidate like this, that's just too embarrassing.
That's right. Now, Ed, your articles and Chris Hedges' articles and to a certain extent Glenn Greenwald, thank heavens, make this focus, because there's this thing where people like to invoke the name Orwell, but people don't remember, it was Harry Truman who initiated the campaign that McCarthy later got on and made a career out of. But Harry Truman was already throwing anybody accused of being a Red or hinted that he might be Red out of the military, out of the State Department. That was under him, a Democrat, who Democrats, of course, still embrace, and also the man who used the atomic weapons. We have to be sober about who these people are. Goldman Sachs Absolutely. Hasn't lost any time or influence through any of these administrations.
No.
But I got to ask you about a woman who is a hero who should be celebrated. Tulsi Gabbard is somebody who actually shows courage and addresses the issues that could save those immigrants – I shouldn't say immigrants – those refugees. Tell me your thoughts about Tulsi Gabbard, her visit to Syria, and her, more importantly, the resolution she's bringing in front of the United States Congress to end support for regime change terror operations.
Well, I don't know Tulsi Gabbard's whole history and voting record. She came to my attention and a lot of our attention in 2016 when she quit the Democratic National Committee to endorse Bernie Sanders mm-hmm. and said that the Democratic National Committee was trying to throw the election to Hillary Clinton. Mm-hmm. And now she's gone to Syria. She came back and said, there are no moderate, quote-unquote, moderate Syrian rebels. This is a fight between terrorists, al-Qaeda and al-Nusra, and the Syrian government. And we should not be arming the terrorists. And for that, she's been roundly denounced.
Yes.
And the Democratic Party outlet, The Daily Coast, and today, there's a really nasty article in the Washington Post how Tulsi Gabbard became Assad's mouthpiece in Washington.
Assad's what?
Mouthpiece.
Mouthpiece. Yeah.
Well, the Daily Coast piece was called her Assad's stooge.
Yeah.
And demanded that somebody step up to challenge her in the next Democratic primary that she has to run in Hawaii.
From what I know of her support, she can beat them. Her constituency, I think, elected her by 80% last time.
I didn't know that, but you know, I hope it's true. I just got to say,
she's a veteran. By the way,
if I were Tulsi Gabbard, I would be. Oh, excuse me. Go ahead.
No, no. I just wanted to add that point that she's a major in the section of the U.S. military. I forget which one. I think it might be just the Army. But she had two tours of duty in Iraq. She knows whereof she speaks. But it, but it's very striking that just a smear job like that, when actually there's no shortage of data and information coming from any of the departments you like, Pentagon, State Department, out of John Kerry's own mouth, once out of the mouth of Hillary herself, that these people are terrorists. And the U.S. is has been supporting them for tactical reasons.
If I were Tulsi Gabbard, I would be watching my back. I would be a little uneasy about flying, frankly.
Well, indeed. I mean, here you are in a situation. I mean, we've had some of these people go who have visited Syria. They all of them are getting a rough time in this continent that claims to be appreciative of civil liberties, civil rights, and respect freedom of speech. All of it, the demonization begins in such a way that people are – they basically intimidated from holding the kind of meetings and discussions on air, as we're doing now, that would permit the American public to have any other point of view than that of the Post, New York Times, CNN.
Yeah, and when Glenn Greenwald was on the Jimmy Dore show, he said, I think what a lot of us are feeling, that is afraid that – if Trump opposed war, as he has in Syria and on the NATO border, at least up to now, the Democrats will argue in favor of it.
Yes.
Because they will argue in favor of anything that Trump proposes.
Yes. That is a scary. Go ahead.
There's something I want to be really clear about because some people are misunderstanding me about this, and that is that I'm not dissing the protests, the people getting out in the streets. I mean, that's really important. A lot of people are asking, okay, where were you when we demolished Libya and so forth? But the more important thing is that people are, you know, there's huge crowds in the streets. The airports are full of protesters. And, you know, we need to keep making the point that all these refugees are trying to get to safety here because of these wars that we're responsible for in seven Muslim countries. If we don't keep making that point and we allow the Democratic Party to take over this energy and channel it and repeat the demand that we stop Trump, I mean, you know, when newscasters are talking to a lot of the protesters, they say they're going to stop Trump. Mm-hmm. Well, that's fine. They should stop Trump with regard to this. But stopping Trump alone is not enough. They've got to stop the Democrats who created this situation.
Yes, exactly. Go ahead.
But no, it's great. It's great. I have still been sick. And so I haven't been out to the airport. But if this continues until I get well, which it seems very likely to, I will go out to the airport just to get a feel for the energy myself.
Mm-hmm.
And one thing I keep saying is that when these Democrats show up to have their picture taken at the airport, they should be booed.
Absolutely.
They should be roundly booed.
Yes.
In front of all the cameras.
Yes.
And people should have signs.
Yes.
Saying that the Democrats supported these wars, which created all these refugees.
Yes. We have, yes.
Go ahead.
No, I was just going to say, joining with your point, and I'm thinking of Chris Hedges. You mentioned him in your article. We got to get out of the duopoly. It's your trap. And you're never going to have a sensible agenda until people make it themselves separate from those two parties, which are controlled by Wall Street.
The other publication we should mention here is the Black Agenda Report.
Yes.
The Black Agenda Report has been right on target for so long. And, you know, as a black publication, they have leave to criticize the Black Congressional Caucus, which yes. they have rightly and mercilessly. And I called Bruce Dixon, the managing editor of the BAR, last week when John Lewis was making hay about, it was after John Lewis had blamed Russia for the Democrats losing the election. And then Trump had responded that that was ridiculous and said some nasty things about John Lewis. And for those who don't know, John Lewis is someone who made his reputation marching for civil rights in the South during the Civil Rights Movement. Then he was elected to Congress.
Mm-hmm.
And he's been there ever since. He didn't vote against these wars. In fact, the Navy's going to name a ship after him too.
Yeah, well, he was a regime changer too.
Yeah, but that's
a concept. Go ahead.
So Trump said these nasty things about him, and then the headlines. And this happened even in Democracy Now. The headlines in the story were: Trump attacks civil rights icon John Lewis on the Martin Luther King holiday.
Yeah.
It said nothing about the fact that he was attacking him because he said that the Russians had stolen the election from the Democrats.
Yes. Yeah. No, that is...
What I was saying was that I called to thank the BAR for how much they have done to make us understand the Congressional Black Caucus, which was for a long time the most radical in Congress.
Mm-hmm.
They have made us understand what it has become and what its various members, including John Lewis, have become.
Yes, it's a sad truth, and it's got to be pointed out. And Black Agenda Report is a terrific site. I agree with you.
I have one more thought here.
Yes.
I think that some of us, as women, have the same kind of leave now to criticize the women legislators who are on their high horse, along with John Lewis, who have all taken this Russia did it to us dance, and who supported these various wars. Nancy Pelosi being one of the most prominent, perhaps the most prominent. We need to do the same thing.
Yes,
because
absolutely.
This women's umbrella that was cast over the Women's March, that's going to continue. And we have to be able to stand up for reproductive rights. Absolutely. While not gathering under this big umbrella that includes Gloria Steinem and Nancy Pelosi and Ashley Judd and Condoleezza Rice.
Yes. No, absolutely. Well, I think you summarized it very nicely. It's Ann Garrison. By the way, the article is in Counterpunch, January 26th, the Women's March in Washington, D.C., as broadcast. And you can also read Ann at Black Agenda Report, which is a great site. Thank you very, very much, Ann. It's a terrific article.
Thanks for calling me. Bye-bye.
Okey-doke. Bye-bye. Taylor Report, CIUT, 89.5 FM. And that was a very refreshing, you know, from, in my opinion. Tulsi Gabbard, by the way, people want to go into this thing of, well, what is her voting record? I don't know what it is, but she has stood up in the American Congress and challenged the regime change strategy, which the Wall Street, Washington Post, New York Times have all agreed on and has created, as she said, 7 Muslim countries being bombed almost all the time at the same, and a Pentagon that is drunk on weapons and bullying. And in Canada, we have, everybody just is comfortable. We don't have masses of people in the streets when weapons are sold to the royal family of Saudi Arabia, because the country is belongs to the royal family. It's not an independent country. It belongs to the family. And they are the richest country in the Middle East. And by the way, they're not on Trump's list, and they weren't on Obama's list. They've always had a privileged relationship to power. So why don't we just say that, privileged relationship. And they are the richest Middle Eastern state, and they are bombing the poorest, Yemen, because they want Yemen to have a different government than the one that people of Yemen want. Canada has no problem. There's no NDPer demanding and pounding and pointing and no. This is a business as usual, war business. And to be, all wanting to look at the man with the funny hair in Washington, that ain't getting it done. Trying to create a population of suckers, frankly. I don't think that they're going to get away with it.
Listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, Mumia Abu-Jabal's radio essay.
Al Jarreau, 1940-2017. Al Jarreau was a musical genius. He was a jazz artist, a soul singer, and a pop sensation who thrilled audiences with his mastery of song. Born in Milwaukee, Wisconsin on March the 12th, 1940. He was the son of a vicar and earned a master's degree in psychology from the University of Iowa. But what the world lost in psychology, it more than gained in the world of music. In his career, he earned 7 Grammys and had 5 top 10 hits, among them We're in This Love Together, which hit the Billboard charts and rose to number 6 in July 1981. We're in this love together, kind of love that lasts forever. It remained a hit for 19 weeks. He sang the theme song for the TV show Moonlighting, starring Bruce Willis and Cybill Shepherd. And his 1988 effort shot to number 2 on the charts, called So Good. Jarreau had a sweet tenor, and his love of singing and music was infectious. Al Jarreau now sings with the ancestors. From Imprison Nation, this is Mumia Abu-Jamal. These commentaries are recorded by Noel Hanrahan of Prison Radio. Of the Black Lives Matter movement, now comes the rise of Law for Black Lives, a collective of lawyers, law students, jailhouse lawyers, and other legal workers in support of the latest iteration of the Black Freedom Movement. It couldn't come at a better time. For times of social movements need all the legal assistance it can muster. For those who oppose that system of white supremacy and rampant necrophobia are often targeted by that same system for special punishment. Perhaps the most renowned black lawyer in U.S. history, Charles Hamilton Houston, who trained Thurgood Marshall in the law, taught his students, a lawyer's either a social engineer or he's a parasite on society. Today, of course, he'd say she. Marshall, Houston's star pupil, who later went on to become the nation's first black Supreme Court justice, would recount one of his law professor's most potent lessons. There's no law on our side? Let's make some. I carry these words to L4BL. Let's make some. But I hasten to add this lesson from a jailhouse lawyer. The law is a tool of the state, often used for repression. Where are the lawyers challenging unjust and unconstitutional laws like Clinton's Anti-Terrorist and Effective Death Penalty Act, known as AEDPA, A-E-D-P-A, or the Prison Litigation Reform Act? These so-called laws were designed to enshrine injustice in statute. The gay rights movement forced the fall of DOMA, the patently unconstitutional Defense of Marriage Act. It's time for the black freedom movement to force the fall of AEDPA and PLRA, acts based on lies and injustice, which have contributed to mass incarceration. I've quoted a preeminent law professor. Now, let me quote an outlaw, revolutionary naturalist John Africa of the MOVE organization, a man bombed by the government on May 13, 1985 in Philadelphia. This is what John Africa taught MOVE members. Just because it's legal, don't make it right. Remember, the Holocaust was legal. Slavery, one of the greatest crimes against humanity, was legal. The mass internment of Japanese Americans, according to the U.S. Supreme Court's Korematsu decision, was legal. All of this was legal. But was it right? To L4BL, let's fight for what's right. For freedom, not mass incarceration. For justice, not repression. Because black lives matter, all black lives matter. On the MOVE, long live John Africa, all power to the people. From imprisoned nation, this is Mumia Abu-Jamal. These commentaries are recorded by Noel Hanrahan of Prison Radio. Mean men. The regime of Donald Trump has radiated a global aura of dread, fear, and the bare teeth of the state as a predator hungry for power. From day one, the Trump regime has used fear, innuendo, and lies to sell its program of repression, so much so that one of the most conservative institutions of government, the courts, have been forced to slap down Trump's maniac Muslim ban. Former U.S. Chief Justice William Rehnquist once opined that in times of war, the courts are silent. This axiom provided that the president had his strongest hand in cases involving national security. Because Trump was so ham-handed, he signed an executive order that essentially dared the courts to defy him, barring Muslims, especially Syrian Muslims, from entry into the U.S., even those who had visas approving entry. His defeat at the hands of the Court of Appeals was epic in scope. But even an illegal, unconstitutional executive order affects real lives, separating and shattering families, tearing parents from their American-born children, sowing the seeds of grief and pain that will last for generations. Donald Trump rode the wave of fear and xenophobia and lies into the Oval Office and is stoking the embers of racial hatred for power. He represents the dying generation of people who see their way of life passing away. They are biting, bitching, and clawing to hold back the clock of change. They will not go quietly into the night. They will spill their guts of fear and terror against change and fight like hell as they try to make America white again. From Imprisoned Nation, this is Mumia Abu-Jamal.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, The Michael Slate Show.
Welcome to the Michael Slate Show. I'm your host, Michael Slate. We have an amazing show lined up for you today. At the back end of the show, we'll be talking with filmmaker Maggie Greenwald about her latest film, which is Sophie and the Rising Sun, a really killer film, a really great film. But it's also a film that you most likely have not seen because it has been quietly buried in the time of Trump. But when you listen to this interview, you'll get a sense of why you need to see that film. And I'll be offering up some ideas on how people can get it to their areas. So check that out. But opening the show up, I'm really pleased to be doing this segment. Claudia Kunz, who is a historian of Nazi Germany, she teaches at Duke University. She wrote the books Mothers in the Fatherland and The Nazi Conscience, as well as other works. And Claudia is speaking with us today on the rise of fascism in Germany and what it has to do with recent developments in the U.S. And I'm very pleased to welcome her to the show. Claudia, welcome to the show.
Oh, thank you.
Let's first talk about how, in broad strokes, your book, you pick it up and you start reading it, and it's very difficult to put it down. And it's very difficult to sit there and not, like, have your bones chilled as you're reading it when you're looking at this and you're saying, how the hell did this happen? So in broad strokes, let's talk about how fascism developed in Germany.
Okay, first of all, let's remember that nobody ever heard of Hitler until the early 30s. He was unemployed. The only steady job he ever had in his life was when he fought in World War I for 4 years. He was quite brave. This was a splinter party. In 1928, as late as 1928, 10 years after the defeat in World War I, the Nazis got 2.6% of the vote. 1930, they got 18% of the vote. 1932, they were up to the high point ever, 37.4% of the vote. So the Nazis never were voted into power. Hitler was appointed into power. So the question is, how did this disreputable fringe party of loudmouth, brawling stormtroopers get from a tiny splinter party to the center in 1932? Which put Hitler in position to get appointed as chancellor, because he was like the prime minister, there was a president above him. Okay, what happened was the Great Depression. Suddenly, one-third of all Germans were unemployed. The government was in gridlock. People were desperate. And Goebbels, Hitler's sidekick for media, had an important insight. He said, we can use democracy to kill democracy. We come, this is a famous statement, we come like wolves to the sheepfold. We will take over. And so that's the crucial thing to look at. What happened between 1930 and 1934 that landed Hitler in a position where he was prime minister, chancellor? And part of that answer has to do with the incompetence and the cluelessness of his opponents, who didn't think he was very dangerous until too late. And also, one thing I should remind you of is that the Germans were educated. Their voter turnout was above 88% all the way through the whole Weimar Republic. These were smart people. And Hitler was appointed chancellor January 1933. Still didn't have a majority. He had to get a majority. Then what happened is the Reichstag burned down. It would be like the Congress, the House of Congress, was burned down. The fire was sufficiently bad. Hitler blamed it on the communists. He called the representatives to the Reichstag, kept communists out, and this time there was another election, the national election. Hitler still only got 44% for the Nazis. And finally, in the middle of March 1934, the government, that is, the politicians, did what the people didn't. The politicians caved in and voted Hitler as chancellor. And from that point forward, he just moved so fast, nobody caught up to him.
You know, it kind of models or reminds you of what happened with Trump and the way he got put into office.
Right. So it'll Trump's be from completely outside. The outsider has so much credibility just because of their incompetence, because of their lack of experience.
Then you have the Electoral College that actually had some kind of role to play in, like, looks like we're going to put this guy in because we want him.
We are in a lot more trouble constitutionally than Germany was. Germany had a great constitution.
In the book, you talk about the road to Auschwitz was paved with righteousness. And I thought that was an important point for people to think about.
Right. Ordinary people can't do evil unless they see it as good, unless they see it as protective. So until the 1980s, the Germans said, oh, we didn't know anything about it. Then they said, well, maybe people knew about it, but just an evil, you know, a few bad apples. Then the next question, well, maybe they were just like robots. And I wrote my book, actually, The Mothers and the Fatherland, in this one, to point out that you can't deport from Nazi-occupied territories. You can't have Germans deporting 675,000 other Germans that who were Jewish and unwanted without a lot of collaboration at the local level. And people have to believe that what they are doing is protective because they believe they're in such great danger, like in a wartime. That's the question. How people feel righteous and good when they do the very evil thing of sending friends and neighbors, betraying friends and neighbors at the grass level.
It's
collaborating in the actual killing site.
And it's heavy because it's something that gets repeated throughout the entire history of that regime. It's very, very heavy, and we'll talk about that a little bit later, too. But your title of the book is Nazi Conscience, and you begin it by saying that Nazi conscience is not an oxymoron. But as I was telling you earlier, it kind of made my head snap, because, and to many That's people, not. The words of Nazi and conscience are never conceived of as two words that would go together anywhere.
We're so naive, we believe that there's a universal conscience, like thou shalt not kill. And do unto others. But actually, when you think about it, Freud had this insight, too. He said it's hard to do unto others who are not like yourselves. And that reminds me of a Nazi slogan. Do unto others as you would like others to do unto you. But in the German, it's clearer. Others are people like you. Do unto others who are like yourself.
You're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and we're talking today with Claudia Kunz, a professor of history at Duke University, the author of Mothers in the Fatherland and a Nazi Conscience, and we're talking about the rise and consolidation of fascism in the past with an eye on recent developments in the U.S. and the threat of the consolidation of a fascist government here. There's another point that you raise in this, which is, again, really struck me. You quote Carl Schmitt. And he was a big Hitler supporter. He denounced the concept of universal human rights when he was questioned about that. And he denounced it by saying, you know, listen, not every being with a human face is a human. And you say that this statement, which just sort of makes your head spin, you say that this is the bedrock of Nazi morality. What do you mean?
What I mean is Schmitt didn't think Jews had a human face. He looked at their faces. A visual is so important. He looked at their faces and he said, these people are subhumans. There are also people who are racially, well, they're disabled, but he said these people are not worthy of life. Life unworthy of living was a Nazi medical belief. And so they were able to sense whole categories of human beings outside of the realm of moral obligation. Let me give you an example. A young man in the eighth grade, in 1938, he saw his best friend Heinz being taken off in 1938, being taken off to a concentration camp. It was his best friend. Heinz and he grew up together. And he said, looking back, his name was Philip, he said, you know, when I saw them taking Heinz, I didn't say, isn't it terrible they're taking Heinz? He said, isn't it a shame that Heinz is a Jew? That's what happened to his conscience. And he grew up later, came to this country, he wrote a book, and he recognized his ways. But that was his view.
When you're talking about that, it's kind of heavy because it's like this point about a normalization that grew up around fascist rule in Germany. And it lasted quite some time. But I keep wondering, how the hell did this happen? There's all these people, like you said, there's these people who thought this, they thought that, they recognized what Hitler was saying, but they thought that it was part of their moral stand or whatever, and that it was something that was okay to be doing for the interests of Germany. How did this happen? And what was this normalization around fascist rule in Germany up until 39? What actually made that work?
Well, let's think about one of the reasons it worked is because Hitler engineered an economic recovery. Hitler understood that he needed experts in his cabinet, for example. His first cabinet had 12 members and only three were Nazis. And the genius behind the economic recovery was actually a founding member of the German Democratic Party. And he was a Keynesian. They borrowed tremendously, and here was his formula. Massive rearmament, because Germany had been disarmed after World War I, infrastructure development, lots of big construction projects, and then labor-intensive projects to give people jobs, like the WPA in the United States. And so all that was going on. By 1936, there was no more unemployment. 3 years, unemployment went from 30% to zero. And all this time, Hitler's diplomatic corps, who were extremely skilled, were being appeased by the West. So Hitler was going from one diplomatic victory to another. And so the combination of domestic rebuilding and international prestige made Hitler very popular. And let's also remember, the Germans read Hemingway, they loved Gone with the Wind, they read Faulkner, they drove Fords, they drank Cokes, they went to church. Germans got the first paid vacations of any workers in the world. They went to mass motels and cruise ships. Just the very first week of Nazi power, just for example, and how important the psychology was, the Nazis were geniuses at this. People in small towns that were buildings were looking kind of shabby got free house paint if they repainted the outside of their houses just so it looks better. That's what normalization looked like. And so people then had a kind of yes-but attitude. Yeah, the Nazis are terrible, but look what they did. So there was a record of real achievement that is hard for us to remember, but it was real.
Now, Claudia, let's talk about this. Who was the actual social base for the Nazis and Hitler, and why?
Yeah, first of all, the Germans keep very good records, so we know how every little district voted for the whole 13 years before the Nazis took over. They even tabulated male and female votes separately. How did they do that? They had women vote on white slips and men vote on gray slips. So we have an exact knowledge of who voted for Hitler. And who voted for Hitler, we would call today the left behind. The people who felt that they were not getting a fair share, that the cities were booming, that the wealthy people were doing okay despite the Depression. They had been through a terrible inflation in 1923. They felt they lost everything. These were the left behind. But the other thing we know, because we have such good voting records, is we say, okay, look at the Nazi Party vote increase, and we can see what parties, and there were five major parties, which parties lost votes to the Nazis before 33, and who held their own. The parties that held their own votes were the Socialist parties, the Catholic parties, and the Communist parties. These three parties were parties that we can't even imagine today because they were subcultures. They had sporting events. They had singing events. They had paramilitary marching. So these three categories of voters did not switch their votes for Hitler. We know that women, first-time voters, that is young women and young people, disproportionately voted for Hitler, but a majority of women never voted for Hitler. But that last-minute bandwagon effect was fueled in part by people who'd never voted before, that is young people and women. So that's before 33. After 33, when it became clear that the Nazis would be in power for some time to come, and remember, the Nazis right from the beginning were arresting communists, they were arresting people who spoke out against them. The first concentration camp in Dachau was set up in 1933 right away, and suddenly the Nazis became the real party. And ordinary people, middle-class people, began to think, well, maybe it's not so bad because we are not being affected. Our lives are doing better. And, of course, there's the famous statement by a very famous pastor, Martin Niemöller, oh, when they came for the socialists, when they came for the communists, I didn't worry, and then they came for the Catholics. Oh, and when they came for me, there was no one left to defend me. And people got seduced.
You're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and we're talking today with Claudia Kunz, a professor of history at Duke University, the author of Mothers in the Fatherland and A Nazi Conscience, and we're talking about the rise and consolidation of fascism in the past with an eye on recent developments in the U.S. and the threat of the consolidation of a fascist government here. It's bone-chilling, but it's something that we have to really explore and understand because we're faced with a very similar situation in a lot of ways today in terms of what's going on in the country broadly and what's actually needed. And that reminds me of something because I was thinking about this, and it was very good that there was this large women's march just after Trump's inauguration, but they raised something else to me in terms of the people that need to be in the streets now and doing all kinds of things now to stand up against Trump. And I thought of one thing that in particular people need to understand, because if you went around telling people, look, you're talking about fascism, you're talking about a fascist there, you're talking about somebody who, if you study what happened in Germany, you study that, you study what's happened in other places, but in particular Germany, you look at this and you can draw a lot of line between what goes on with Trump and what was going on with Hitler and the Nazis. Now, you wrote, and I wanted to give people just a sense in general about this, like after the Women's March, I was thinking about your book, Mothers in the Fatherland, and Women, the Family, and Nazi Politics, and it was a very heavy book. And I wanted to ask you about that. What did fascism mean for women in Germany? Because it's one thing when you hear about the men and what happened to them and how they were appealed to, and there was all the stuff that was going on specifically aimed at men, but there was a lot of stuff that was happening with women that I thought was very, very heavy and sort of, one, denied their humanity, but two, was something that a lot of people just don't know about in relation to fascism.
Well, that's why I wrote the book, because I was in the 80s and all my friends in Germany said, oh, yeah, my dad was bad, but my mother was really good. And so I went to the archives, and I found out that actually when you want to know how Hitler's ideology permeated at the grassroots, women are at the center of that story. They're the mothers who send their kids off to the Hitler Youth. They're the local knitting society that gets brown yarn for free. They call themselves, some of them call themselves, Hitler's little brown geese. Can you imagine? That they were proud of being recognized as women. The head of the organization, I kid you not, the name was really Gertrude Schultz-Klink. Gertrude Schultz-Klink headed up an organization of 9 million women, all out there volunteering, collecting charity for the needy, cooking meals for the hungry, organizing charity. Everything was organized, even charity. And so women felt proud of doing their womanly activities, womanly so-called. And the fact that they were kept out of high places didn't bother them as much as we might think it would. Not that many women were in the universities to begin with.
The other place that actually was had a lot to do with like what happened with Hitler's reputation, what happened with fascism in Germany, and how it was rolled out a carpet for them to be received on was in the universities. And the fact that the universities actually were very open to Hitler. And that was something that really, I think, would shock a lot of people. To me, it was interesting because when I saw you really went after Heidegger, I was very happy because you don't know how many arguments I've had with people about Heidegger. And, you know, people always look at him as like, oh, well, you know, we study him. So let's talk about this. What about the universities and the Nazis, the relationship there?
You would think. I work in a university, so I would think that the universities would be the first to see the danger. Not at all. First of all, actually, Jewish professors were overrepresented in the ranks of academe, and 10% of all professors were fired because they were Jewish in 1933. And in a time when there were no jobs available, that meant a lot of PhDs got jobs. So there's that absolutely material benefit. And while we're talking about Jews, also too, middle-class professors were about as anti-Semitic as other people, but while we're talking about Jews, I'd like to ask your listeners to imagine, think of what percentage of all Germans in 1933 were Jewish. Just pause for a minute, get that percentage correct, and I bet not many of you guessed under 1%. So we're looking at a very small population, quite different from the population, the African-American population, which is around 15 to 18% in this country. And so there's a very big difference. And the amount of anti-Semitism in the universities was actually quite strong. And so that was one reason. The other thing that the Hitler administration did is to recruit followers in the universities who would serve as legal experts, who would justify racial politics. The funding dried up for what we would call liberal research, but funding was suddenly available for research in race, how race impacts literature, racial thinking impacts social work. So the racialization of the curriculum meant all kinds of new funding opportunities. And so as we're looking to what's going to happen now about funding for climate change, we can see that kind of incentive system shifting. And so suddenly the availability of jobs, funding, and prestige was irresistible. And I have to say that the historians were particularly awful. They took a lot of the history that had been written by Jews, talking about all of Jews' wonderful contributions in many, many areas, And they took all that research and they said, see, there's been a Jewish conspiracy. They just plagiarized and turned pride into insult. So the universities were not a bastion of free speech.
It's very heavy reading that in your book. In fact, as you go through it and you get all the way up to 39 and the role that the universities played, I mean, they were like steamrollers for Hitler. It was very, very heavy.
They called it the Brown steamroller.
Well, let's talk about this because I want to start getting into some of the similarities between what's happening with the Trump regime and what happened in Nazi Germany. And one of the things I can't help, and I think I wrote to you earlier about this, but you talked a lot about the professional popularizers for the Nazi regime. One put out the booklet called Der Stürmer, and the other was Das Schwarze Korps. And I read this part of the book. I kept thinking about, guess what, Breitbart. And this is kind of right there, you know?
It's right there. And, of course, now we look back and the technology was primitive. But the Nazis – oh, and one thing to remember is before 33, no politics on the radio. So radio was not an option. But the Nazis were way ahead of the curve. As soon as electric amplification of the voice became possible, they had it. They had movies. They used film strips. They had 72,000 versions of one slideshow that went out but displayed by the Hitler Youth. They were at the technological front of the media always. They had insiders, newspapers for party members, and huge mass circulation newspaper, their own national news circulation, with fake news, fake facts everywhere. And this was very, very important, that they were technologically night and day more sophisticated than any of their other political rivals.
You know, one thing that I kept thinking about as I was reading about this, now these two, particularly Der Stürmer and Das Schwarze Korps, these were two different publications, right? These were print publications, and one was from the SS and one was from the Stormtroopers, right? And one was geared towards a sort of a more brutish audience, and the other was geared towards a more intellectual audience, it seemed. So what? Yeah, let's talk about that a little bit.
Well, because they understood how to segment their audience. And so that the Stürmer was filled with disgusting anti-Semitic cartoons and outrageous lies, like the National Enquirer. But the Schwarze Korps, which is for the SS, which is the elite, had scientific articles. It had pictures of important people. It looked like a professional association in the day. Had racial science there. It had geopolitics. It had interviews with government dignitaries. It appealed to the elite.
You're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and we're talking today with Claudia Kunz, a professor of history at Duke University, the author of Mothers in the Fatherland and A Nazi Conscience. And we're talking about the rise and consolidation of fascism in the past with an eye on recent developments in the U.S. and the threat of the consolidation of a fascist government here. Let me ask you this, and this is something you also had been thinking about a lot as you wrote to me this morning, the structural similarities and situations that encourage racist populism. And, you know, this is exactly what we're looking at when we're looking at the regime in power in the U.S. right now in terms of this kind of encouraging racist populism. And let's talk about that, the structural similarities in these situations.
Well, you know, I can't resist pointing out to one enormous difference, and that is, of course, the structural similarities are here. We have a group of people who feel left out, left behind, but our situation in some ways is different because, and that's why I think fascism isn't so helpful, because we have a unique situation. When you look at the white supremacy tradition in this country, we've been a country that has been for 270 years, my math is probably a little weak, we have been a country where white supremacy has been legal all years except for 77 years. Except for 77 years, we have been a white supremacist country. That didn't exist in Germany. And that makes us structurally incredibly different, and I think we always have to remember we're more like apartheid in South Africa under de Klerk than in that respect than in Nazi Germany. So it's important when we're doing the comparisons to remember that there are some alarming differences too, not necessarily better. But structurally, we have a developed democracy that people take for granted. We think our wonderful history is going to protect us because we tend to think of history as being upward and onward, always getting better. We don't see it as a battle. We have two traditions in this country, the tradition of the Enlightenment, the tradition of human rights, human dignity, and then we have the tradition of white supremacy, and they're both confronting one another right now. And Germany didn't have that legacy of white supremacy, and the Jewish population was minuscule. So that's one element that makes us different.
What about the similarities on the other hand?
Well, similarities. I can't resist drawing some similarities in the way in which people seem to follow an outsider leader. Now, you can look at Hitler, and of course, he's ridiculous. He's got a shock of hair. He had no political experience. He got the idea for his mustache when he saw his first Charlie Chaplin movie. He had himself, he was extremely vain. He particularly liked that mop of hair that came down in front of his eyes. He had a photographer with him at all times. The photographer took pictures of his gestures, which he repeated. He could not follow a script. He had to extemporaneously speak because he had to have feedback from his audience. And in fact, in 1932, he was so vain, his photographer, personal photographer, took dozens of pictures for him in different poses so that his annual picture wouldn't look aged. He curated an image for himself, the opposite of Trump, but therefore interesting because it was extreme. He's a simple man, a bachelor, a teetotaler, a vegetarian who wore rumpled suits. He appeared kind of harmless. So that, in an odd way, won him the trust of people who were so disillusioned with the main political parties of the day. So from the opposite end of the social scale, we have this outsider capturing the disenfranchised, people who feel disenfranchised, because of an extraordinary ability to understand the media. Hitler also was a master at making headlines of the provocative statement. He would always make outrageous statements. Didn't matter if they weren't so true. He said, yeah, tell a lie, tell a big lie. It always leaves a trace.
Let's talk about this. You mentioned to me that you're very worried these days, and I want to talk about that because I think you're not alone, okay?
I'm very worried today because in some ways, Hitler was more cautious. He had to be more cautious because of the Constitution, because there was a president over him, and he never got more than a third of the vote. And there was no voter fraud in Nazi Germany, P.S. I'm very worried because what I see is a president whose ignorance is legendary. And he has a Rasputin, Steve Bannon. Hitler didn't need anybody else. Hitler read whole books, believe it or not. He only remembered what he agreed with, but still. I think I'm worried because we, like the Germans, have a political culture that depends on goodwill and shared norms, politicians who respect those norms. We take it for granted. We're looking at a regime that has a businessman's ethic, and a businessman looks for loopholes and looks at respect for your enemy, so-called, respect for your person in the other party, as being a sign of weakness or stupidity. We also have a track record in this country, a right-wing movement that's extremely well-funded. Read Dark Money from 1973 when ALEC, the think tank that produces legislation for right-wing politicians, was founded, the Koch brothers. Here in North Carolina, we have the Pope brothers. And here in North Carolina, too, we see what you people in California under Jerry Brown don't see. We see how the Republicans are behaving. That is to say, cutting out, finding every loophole, doing absolutely everything they can to block progressive legislation, to cut back the rolls of Medicare. They're ruthless, and we're learning very quickly how to fight that. And it's a steep learning curve, but we've got to learn fast. And that's what scares me. And so the bottom line is, I think what frightens me most is that progressives in pre-Nazi Germany, in late Weimar Germany, progressives were blindsided by the speed and the ruthlessness with which Hitler seized power. And that's what I'm afraid. In a way, I guess, remember Franklin Roosevelt said in the 30s, the only thing we have to fear is fear itself. I think the only thing we have to fear is not being afraid enough. Even though the parallels are not perfect with Nazi Germany, what is similar is the weakness of progressives, people of goodwill, liberals, lefties, call them what you will, defenders of human rights, our weakness when confronted with overwhelming force, financial and legal, we hope legal not yet. So that's why I'm scared.
Well, you got me too. Okay. I think everybody in the other room is scared too. It's actually something to be really cognizant of in terms of what's happening among the people themselves. And that's what I wanted to ask you for certain, because it's very much linked to what you just spoke about. What do you want people to take away from this book and the whole thing that you've been laying out here?
Well, what I want them to take away And I see it here in North Carolina, where we have an incredible movement of resistance. We have still a free press. We have Reverend Barber Moral Mondays. We have grassroots organizations going out everywhere. And we still have a free press. We're still using it. We march. We have mobilizations. And we have a court system that is stronger than they ever had in Nazi Germany. So we need to look at what the resources are we have to mobilize, because we've got a chance as long as we make activism part of everyday life.
Claudia Kunz, thank you very much for joining us today.
Thank you.
Talk to you again soon.
Thanks.
Take care now.
Bye.
You're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and we've just been talking with Claudia Kunz, historian of Nazi Germany, author of The Nazi Conscience and Mothers in the Fatherland. The book poses the question, how does it happen that citizens who consider themselves deeply moral can believe that some of their fellow citizens embody a danger so lethal that they must be eliminated? You're listening to The Michael Slate Show. We're going to take a quick musical break and be right back, so stay tuned.
Bibles, guns, and flags. Oh, rock me in the cradle, child, carry me to the grave. Pledge allegiance to the doctrine, know you're gonna be saved. My Bibles, guns, and flags. Everybody fall in line, praise the Lord and do the time. Follow the rules, forget the truth, 21 gun salute. Bibles, guns, and flags.
All right, welcome back. Once again, that was Sonny Meadows with Bibles, Guns, and Flags. And you're going to have to keep hearing that song. The worse things get, the more we're going to have to hear that song, right? That's just how I feel right now. But I decided to bring you a special part of the program today. Last year at Sundance Film Festival, I had the opportunity to interview Maggie Greenwald. And Maggie is a filmmaker, and she's the director of the film called Sophie and the Rising Sun. Now, many of you may not have even seen the film or heard about it, but you should have. And we'll talk at the end of this interview about how you can get in touch with the distributor of the film and arrange to have it shown in your city, in your neighborhood, at your schools, wherever you are. This is a film that should not be missed. This is a film that we cannot allow to be buried somewhere and not seen for many, many years. It's a film that is extremely important in the climate today. So without any further ado, I'm going to jump into the interview, and we'll come back at the end and talk about how you can arrange to get hold of that film.
All right. The first film that I saw here at Sundance, at the Sundance Film Festival this year, was one that just knocked me back in my seat, and I kept thinking about the entire time I was here. The film is Sophie and the Rising Sun, and it's written and directed by Maggie Greenwald. And Maggie Greenwald is joining us today to talk about this. Maggie, welcome to the show.
Thanks, Michael.
I gave a brief description of the film. Tell people what the film's about.
Well, the film is based on a novel written by Augusta Trobaugh. The film is set in the autumn of 1941 in a small southern town, and an itinerant Japanese or Asian American man shows up in the town under mysterious circumstances, and he's taken in by a wealthy woman and becomes her gardener, but he secretly begins a love affair with the town spinster. And just as they're being discovered and trouble is starting around that, Pearl Harbor happens, and what starts out as, you know, prejudice becomes very violent bigotry and hatred. And this group of women who have been involved in caring for him are forced to confront social convention and decide whether they're going to help him or and how they're going to help him to escape.
Now, you, I read someplace where, and I heard you talk about it when we saw the film, you spent 9 years working on this film. And boy, there's a lot involved in that. I'm sure it wasn't all just around making the money to make the film.
No, it wasn't at all. And it wasn't working only on this over the 9 years. The book was brought to me by our executive producer, Nancy Dickinson, about 9 years ago. And she was interested in having me write the adaptation and then stay on to direct the film. So it was a few years of just working on the script. And then you know, began the process of trying to raise financing. And it was not a consistent process, but what did finally become our linchpin was casting Margot Martindale to play Anne, and that fear of losing her triggered the money.
So we
wanted her. She was absolutely our Anne, and so happily everybody got terrified of losing her, and the picture got greenlit.
You know, it's interesting because when you talk about her character Anne, there's so much that revolves around her. She mm-hmm. actually is the linchpin in the film, not just mm-hmm. because of mm-hmm. you know the actor playing her, but mm-hmm. but actually the way everything that's concentrated in her seems to be the thing that everything else revolves around to a certain degree.
That's true. The film is really an ensemble piece more than a single protagonist. Though the love story and Sophie's journey, Sophie's played by Julianne Nicholson, is the central story around which all the relationships evolve and develop. It's really an ensemble piece built around these four women and their relationships that go back to very early in their lives and secrets that they share and how their friendship has affected their relationships have affected their lives.
You know, one of the things that you talk about and some things I've read again that you talked about that for you, a lot of the film was about relations between people. And I thought, okay, you can definitely see that, but there's also so many levels that those relations unfold on. Let's talk about that overall thing about the relations. Then I want to get into some particulars.
Well, do you have a particular question? it is. I mean, for me, the love story between Sophie and Ota, played by Takashi Yamaguchi, is the central story around which four characters, four women's lifelong relationships evolve and develop and devolve. And so for me, there's many love stories in the movie, not just the central romance, but the love story of these long, lifelong friendships or lifelong animosity that have defined the women's lives.
You're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and we're talking today with filmmaker, director, writer Maggie Greenwald about her latest film, Sophie and the Rising Sun. Now, this is a film that you probably have not seen because it has not been given wide release, but it's a killer film, and it has everything to do with what's happening in this country and in the world today. So check this out.
When you have that encompassed in the town itself, and the town functions, and then you can see all the stuff, the church women, and Diane Ladd, actually, by the way, Diane Ladd was a great choice for this.
I forgot to mention Diane Ladd as one of our four women who, I mean, she's absolutely extraordinary, and she's the antagonist, but even her despicable behavior grows out of her love for Sophie, and it's a twisted love, but nonetheless, it is, you know, she does terrible things out of a desire to take care of her.
Well, you know, I didn't get that, actually, that much. I really thought, you know, I thought that actually there was a, well, I want to hear more about that because to me it was more like this woman was actually, she was sort of the town Christian who was going to organize everybody into God's boat, you know. And it was
well, kind of, she is, but she's also, she was, which is mentioned in the story, she was Sophie's mother's best friend. And her son, John, who's an invalid from his World War I injuries, is the same age as Sophie, a middle-aged person. And so she says at one point, she's my best friend's child. I have to protect her, even if it's from her own wicked ways. Mm-hmm. And I think that, I do believe that, you know, that she believes in the righteousness of her Christian beliefs and that, you know, those also, as in today, contain a lot of social biases that people believe are contained in their religion, and so she uses those to try and protect Sophie, even though she's in fact causing great harm to everybody.
Mm-hmm. And I could see that when you start from the very beginning, when you actually, you know, from the very beginning when Sophie's a young child, mm-hmm, and mm-hmm. she's playing with her black friend, and Diane Ladd's character is actually, right, you know, rips Sophie away from her and chases, right, the young black woman off, right, the young black girl off the scene.
Yeah.
You know, which brings me to another point in this relation, and we're just going to deal with some interweaving relations here, because the other thing there was the relationship between black and white people in the film, and it's sort of understated, but it's always there. You know, it's just, and it's a very complex picture. It's not mm-hmm. so simple as sort of white people hate black people, da da da.
Well, it's not simple. There's the only African American in the book is the character of Salome, Queen Sally. And, but I felt very strongly about black and white people being in the town, being in the landscape, and how do they relate to each other. So, for instance, in the, you know, and I am a northerner, and so I felt I needed to tread lightly but be truthful. And, you know, I did a lot of research. So, for instance, in the scene where right after Pearl Harbor, when the young men all line up for the draft, I wondered, well, they wouldn't have been in the same lines. Mm-hmm. And in fact, so, it, you know, in the scene where the young men line up to sign up for the army, there's two lines, a line of white men and a line of black men, which is the way it was. And, you know, the Confederate flag comes out and, you know, because as today, a lot of people in the South feel, you know, connected to that Confederate flag as a sign of their patriotism, certainly in 1941, most of the South probably did.
You know, and there's a lot of layers to this, too, because at the same time, you have another character who's black in the film, mm-hmm. and this young woman who's a maid for Anne.
Mm-hmm.
And when
played by the glorious Lorraine Toussaint.
No, not her.
Before. The first one.
Yeah, we'll get into Lorraine.
Matilda, who's played by Sabrina Mayfield. Yeah.
And it was very heavy because she's going along, she's doing all this stuff. But then the moment that this Asian man's brought into the house to be taken care of, she refuses to do it. And she makes a point of, I'm not going to wait on no, I'm not going to take care of no, you know.
Yellow foreigner.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Well, that, it, you know, there is... and historically has been the same kind of racism, similar kind of racism within the African-American community as the white community. Outsiders are, you know, were frowned upon and in places still are. You know, we're doing a lot of this. That's, you know, really the film, you know, does resonate very much with a lot of what, you know, we've been doing, how we've been treating our Muslim American neighbors and fellow Americans.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I want to get into that in a little bit, but one of the things that really struck me too, I mean, I'm just exploring all these things because mm-hmm. people, you know, the film is so complex, not that it's hard to understand, but it's mm-hmm. got complexity that really draws you in.
Thank you.
Yeah, and so when you're looking at it and you're watching all these things unfold, Sophie herself, who mm-hmm. is pretty much leading this kind of isolated life, she's mm-hmm. happy to be with herself. She's got mm-hmm. she's in this house that's kind of broken down, but it's the mm-hmm. house she grew up in. And she has her routine that she goes to the movies with, you know, with Anne, and she, mm-hmm. you know, and there's the age difference between them, but they're very close friends, and it's almost mother and daughter to mm-hmm. a certain extent. Mm-hmm. But then she also has a thing where she's, you know, when Ota appears in town, mm-hmm. she makes a statement about. What do you want to have that guy in your house for? You know, and Anne says right. something to her that really, you know, it was kind of jolting, I think. Now, you remember what she said?
Yes, of course I do. She says, Sophie says that she saw him in town and he was very dark and very dirty. And Anne just very sharply says, Sophie, intimating, how can you say such a thing? Mm-hmm. Shaming her for her own racism. But Sophie's journey in this story is as someone who is so repressed and someone who, because she was different, has been isolated and developed, created a very narrow existence. Part of her putting on her social best is to say foolish things like that, ugly things like that, which we know, we find out she really doesn't feel.
Mm-hmm.
That, you know, she and that moment is just going along with society, and then Anne calls her on it, and she's deeply ashamed.
Yeah, and without giving anything away, the thing that mm-hmm. Anne calls her on it is remember your own past.
Right.
You know, which is,
right.
you know.
Right. They have a moment of shared memory mm-hmm. at that time.
Yeah, yeah. It's something I thought that really jolted Sophie, mm-hmm. and I thought mm-hmm. it was very good. Even though,
thank you.
And there's this thing that keeps developing too, because Sophie, the other thing with Sophie, you have all this interaction. You have this network mm-hmm. of people. You have even mm-hmm. the character Anne interacts with the church people, and there's mm-hmm. all this. And she's sort of seen as a sort of community leader, spokesperson mm-hmm. for people, and she can put people in their place.
Well, Anne is wealthy. I mean, to me, Anne is first lady of the town. She's very wealthy. Her family's been in that town for many, many generations. So because of that status and her wealth, she's allowed to defy convention. So she doesn't go to church. She doesn't wear a hat when she goes out, which was a choice that Margot made. But yet she's... The leader of the gardening club mm-hmm. in the town, and so she's very much of the town, even though she has these very small ways of defying convention, and her journey is really to how far is she willing to go mm-hmm. to stand up for her beliefs?
Yeah, that's what I was going to get into. Although I want to mm-hmm. do this thing with Sophie first too.
Yes,
Sophie's thing of, I mean, she was so isolated in the town.
You know, yes,
and mm-hmm. she, and this, in a way, there's a story, a coming out story about mm-hmm. Sophie, mm-hmm. you know, and on a lot of different levels, because mm-hmm. she has to do a lot of intellectual breaking with bias and with mm-hmm. you know, narrow thinking mm-hmm. and the rest of this, and also with contentment with the way things are, mm-hmm. even if she doesn't, you know, she may not like it, but she
acceptance.
Out. Yeah, yeah.
She's had to accept a kind of existence that was very narrow, mm-hmm. And also in the story because. Her family had no money. She became the person who supported her mother and herself by crabbing. And so she's doing this very, very inappropriate activity to support them, but she really has to keep that secret and separate. Even though everyone knows, she still has to be split in the person that she is. Mm-hmm. On the one hand, she's very capable and loves being out in nature and is able to support herself by crabbing. But when she comes home and before she goes into society, even with her best friend, she has to put on her proper lady drag and her gloves and her hat. And so she can fit in.
You're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and we're talking today with filmmaker, director, writer Maggie Greenwald about her latest film, Sophie and the Rising Sun. Now, this is a film that you probably have not seen because it has not been given wide release, but it's a killer film, and it has everything to do with what's happening in this country and in the world today. So check this out.
This will start talking about a little bit of the way things break out, because there's that point where Anne also, who has... See, because the other thing with Anne is she has all this stuff about being the first lady of the town, but she also has this thing where she has... She comes across as she has the moral fiber. You mm-hmm. know, she has this, and there's a scene in there where she's actually stunned by something that, you know, she recognized in herself. That was it was a turning point in a lot of ways. Mm-hmm. We don't have to get exactly what it was, but in general.
Yeah, we don't want to give away the whole movie, Michael. We want to entice people to see it.
I know, that's what I'm trying. But that's why you don't have to say what it was. But okay. there's a turning point for her mm-hmm. that actually shakes the hell out of her. Mm-hmm. You know, and you could see that on her face, and you could mm-hmm. see the wrestling with all this. And that's what I was going to try and speak about, is because that's something that for the second half of the film sort of consumes the film to a certain mm-hmm. extent. There's this... It's no longer the sort of the quiet change or the change or the no change or mm-hmm. just minuscule change that happens within the confines of the town and the mm-hmm. reality of the town. There's a lot of breaking with old ideas that people have to go through in this, which is very, very heavy. And you can see the kind of the way people were wrestling with it.
Well, you know, part of my vision with all of my films, the thing that interests me in all of my films is how have women dealt with some of the same moral and human issues that have been portrayed significantly in literature and art and in movies. But we have mostly seen these journeys through more active male behavior. And I like to really look at how would women, because many women going back to, you know, going back and back and back did defy convention, but they did it in different ways from the way perhaps men have done it, and probably quieter ways and more internal ways, and yet have been affected society very significantly, I believe. And so I am very interested in how that internal struggle manifests in taking actions that may be very small, but are very profound and change society.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah. And, you know, one of the things that happens, and we'll move into a little bit more mm-hmm. of the other end of things, because in addition to the relations, and I think you do a remarkable job, really, and I'm not saying that just to butter you up, but, you know, to watch because...
Butter away.
Good, Maggie. Just praise me. I do that, too.
Thank you.
Yeah. Anyway, the thing is that, you know, it's more than just the relationships between people. Mm-hmm. It's this thing that people are struggling with themselves and yes. then helping each other struggle with mm-hmm. in a certain sense. And this question comes out, and I think this is where I want to talk a little bit about Lorraine's mm-hmm. character and Solomon. Mm-hmm. And but I also want to, you know, because it affects everybody. There's a point where people are really wrestling with a moral dilemma. What the hell do you do in the face of this dire situation that they're all presented mm-hmm. with, you know? And interestingly, I think one of the strongest in terms of when you look at it, because it's also one of the characters who's in the background for a lot, even though she comes into the place and she does mm-hmm. this, but she has a very strong sort of moral code that sort of just leaps out of her, which is Salome.
Yes, because as an African American, she gets it better than anybody else. She gets it first. And as someone who has, as a character who has left the tiny town and has tried to step out of being in a place she was supposed to be and has now been forced back because of circumstances into being a maid and having to, as Lorraine described her character, become invisible, she bears witness to and becomes our moral mm-hmm. conscience, I think, in understanding how horrible what's going on is, and that it is these are hate crimes. That's what Lorraine kept saying. She said, I've just witnessed a hate crime. This is a hate crime. And I said, okay, but Lorraine, hate crime is a very contemporary word. This kind of thing was not that unusual in the South, you know. So it was actually in the script I used the word filth, which she uses. Mm-hmm. So as, you know, as an African-American woman, in particular in the South in this period, she gets it, mm-hmm. particularly as someone who has traveled around and been outside of her comfort zone, has mm-hmm. left this little town and now come back.
You know, it's interesting, yeah. And part of the thing is that, now, I remember reading where Nancy Dickinson made some comment about what drove her to this story.
What Nancy Dickinson... a friend of hers gave her the book knowing that she would fall in love with it and want to make it into a film, not just because of the story itself and the relationships of the women, but because she exactly saw the parallel between what the United States, what Americans and our government did to the Japanese Americans during World War II, she could see us beginning to do the same thing to Muslim and Arab Americans. Mm-hmm. And this was 9 years ago, and it's really tragic to say, but things have gotten worse. And there have even been recently, monstrous statements by, politicians in the South talking about interning Muslim Americans mm-hmm. or, you know, Donald Trump talking about registering Muslim Americans. Mm-hmm. I mean, these are Hitler's concepts, to register people, to intern them. These are fascist, you know, this happened. Mm-hmm. And the fact that this conversation is going on in this country is terrifying.
Well, you look
and
at
should terrify every American.
Yeah, yeah. And you look at even the fact, you know, even, but you look at fact of immigrants,
Yes.
The rounding up of immigrants.
Yes.
Tens of thousands.
Yes.
Many more sheltered in these camps.
Yes.
That we don't even know about.
We don't even know where they are. They're secreted away. Mm-hmm. They're swept up. Their families are torn apart. We don't even know where these detention centers are. And, you know, we know that there's incredible abuses going on in them. We know that people have been kept in them for years, and these people, they're gone. They're invisible, and we are doing this.
Mm-hmm. And, you know, when it takes me back to the point about people, part of the thing that really got to me in terms of the different themes that were going on, and that question of morality, that question of how much are you willing to allow to go on before you stand up, or are you going to continue to just close your eyes and pretend it's not there, or do you step up and say something?
Well, I think that question is a question that I believe that probably most human beings face that moment at some point in their life. And I think many of us are at that moment right now because of how severe things are and how vitriolic the conversations are in this country right now against immigrants, against women, against non-white people, African American kids and men being shot by cops, and good cops getting shot. I mean, it's a frightening time.
Yeah, you know, I saw the film Trapped. I don't know if you actually
I did see it.
Yeah.
I saw it.
And
yes.
I thought of your film in relation to
that. Well, that's one of my favorite films that I've seen here, which deals with all of these laws being passed primarily throughout the South that eat away at reproductive freedom and are causing clinics to shut down. And the film follows three abortion providers, women's health clinics that also provide abortions, trying to stay open and trying to fight these trapped laws that are really destructive.
Yeah, and one of the scenes that got me and made me flash on your film again was the point of where the one woman who's taking the incoming calls, and she's trying to work this thing out to get this young woman who had been raped.
Yeah, 13-year-old who'd been raped, who was just within 5 days of the legal limit of being able to have an abortion.
And it looked like she wasn't going to get it.
Yeah.
You know, and you're thinking there...
Well, she didn't get it.
Yeah. You're thinking there of, like, where do you stop? Because, there's a lot of films that I've seen that actually pose this one way or another, to one degree or another, but the sharpness of it there and the sharpness of it in your film, what you decide to do can change things or leave things much worse.
Yes.
You know, it's not a neutral thing. You can and people are called on to make that decision. And
and this was, you know, something that you and I shared in our initial exchange, is that I believe that these small, feel very strongly, I know that these small decisions that people make in these moments to stand up for something have ripple effect and resound throughout society. When you make this decision, it's not just for you and the one person or one little thing that you do. It changes everything.
Mm-hmm. And that comes through really full force in your film.
Thank you.
Yeah,
good.
I mean, it's very, very heavy. Mm-hmm. And I won't give away the ending. But No, I'm not. But I'm just going to say this. I'll just say this in general. Is that it poses the question again. Because, you know, the point is, people have to think about this.
I'm glad it poses the question, because I think our country is poised on the brink of those questions right now.
All right, Maggie, thank you very much. I really enjoyed talking with you.
Me too, Michael. Thank you.
Sure.
All right, as you heard in this interview with Maggie Greenwald, her film is an outstanding piece of work, and it's one that really needs to be seen broadly in this society today. It raises all kinds of questions that are actually at the heart of a lot of what's going on in the world today. But yet, even though that's true, Maggie's film has not gotten the kind of release it needs to get. All right, you've just been listening to an interview I did with filmmaker Maggie Greenwald at the Sundance Film Festival last year. The film Sophie and the Rising Sun is an extremely powerful film, and it's one that needs to be seen today. The film was actually picked up by Monterey Media, which is a small company based here in Los Angeles, and they've been releasing the film around the country for limited runs. If you go to the website for Monterey Media, you will see the list of theaters around the country that are showing the film. It's also streaming on video on demand, and it will be released as a DVD on February 21st. All right, well, that wraps up another edition of the show. I want to thank everyone who made this show possible this week. I also want to let you know, if you want to write to me, you can at mslate@themichaelslateshow.com. And we don't even have time for music this week, so I'm just going to say talk to you again next week.